show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! They're always after me, Lucky Charms.
And that'll be the end of my corny Irish accent for the evening. You're all very welcome for the fact that I'm not doing the entire program like that. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go if you want to jump into the chat room and have a rousing good real-time time with the folks therein enjoying themselves. Jeremy in Vermont noting loud and clear on TuneIn. Thank you very kindly, Jeremy. And we've got a nice in-gathering of folks, more of whom will be wandering along presently. But since you were there early and on time, good evening. A special good evening to Anatole, to News Ninja Carol Baker, to Gerald, to Jeremy in Vermont, to Jug of Punch, and to Texas T, all capably moderated by veteran, indefatigable chat room moderator Sparky, presently manifesting himself as Man Cake. So, no, Gerald, I will not do the whole show that way.
I think I'd go right out of my mind if I were to do it like that.
No. Mm-mm. Can't make me.
Uh-uh.
It is St. Patty's Day, though, so happy St. Patrick's Day to those of you who celebrate it, and I guess at this point in time, just about the whole doggone world celebrates St. Patrick's Day for as just a celebration of Irishness. So, you know,
Figara,
or whatever it is you're supposed to say. And hell, I'm a little bit Irish, and I don't know. But isn't everybody a little bit Irish on this day? No, this is the day that the world celebrates the death of the man who drove the original native religion out of Ireland and supplanted it with Christianity. How that turns out to be a cause for celebration is beyond me, but you know, nobody asked. So there you go. What it also is, though, is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. We got the prayer meeting Wednesday music. We've got the Moran business on Monday. I don't know. Do we need like a big ship's whistle or somebody hollering out, "Iceberg!" Or maybe "Dirtberg!" for Titanic Tuesday? I'm not sure. But it is Titanic Tuesday, and Titanic Tuesday is the day when we celebrate the truly monumental, Titanic, if you will, wit and intellect over, well, in overabundance in the American right wing. The name comes to us down through the years now from a story our buddy Jim told us about the day that the 962nd level, 962nd tier right wing blatherer over in Beckley, America's fifth smallest radio market, took a call from one of his mouth walking, knuckle breathing faithful. I do that on purpose, you know. Who asked him, "Steve, how come you reckon it is these shells, you know, seashells in the rocks in West Virginia? We ain't nowhere near the beach." To which he answered, "Well, caller, that's because of the movement of the Titanic plate." No word yet on the movement of the Titanic turkey baster. But that's where it comes from, and there's a lot to celebrate on any given Titanic Tuesday. I wanted to start with something that our buddy Beth in Dallas alerted us to. But before I do that, a reminder: we do in fact keep all of this going. this is strictly a visual reference, but the old Horn Studio broadcast chair went to its long home over the weekend and was replaced by another old Horn Studio chair. You know, when we started out, we had three. One for Agnes, the producer, one for me, and one in case a guest should happen by. Well, the old Horn Studio chair went to its long home and has been replaced by another long horn old studio chair that has not yet gone to its long home, but probably oughta. And the reason why is, you know, they have that lift function. They've got that piston on them, these kinds of rolling chairs. Well, the piston on this one's all pissed away. And so it's way down low on the ground. Like, I mean, my knees are almost, you know, I'm no shrinking violet. I mean, by no means am I basketball player material, but, you know, I'm 6'2". And I'm sitting just way down close to the ground, and I feel like I'm looking up at everything, and it's just weird, and my neck hurts, and yeah. It's like one of the chairs you put at the children's table at Thanksgiving, where you seat the children and your drunk Republican relatives. Anyway, we do try to keep all of this on the air through your kind contributions, and we try to raise $150 per program, and I have an announcement of a brand new challenge. We've never had this before that I can recall, but I had a note from Tosh saying that he wants to put have a show on me rocket scientist challenge out on the table for this evening. Now, the have a show on me concept was introduced and invented by our buddy Ed, who took care of an evening's entire fundraising all by his lonesome one evening, that's $150, and called it Have a Show on Me. Well, there is a Have a Show on Me challenge on the table this evening, so that we will we'll have an entire show provided by Tosh the Rocket Scientist, if, in fact, we can raise $150 to go with it. So that'll take care of two programs. You know how to do this, right? It's just a matter of going over to headonradionetwork.com, clicking the tab Contribute, filling out the less intrusive fields of the PayPal interface there, never mind the field that asks you for your employer's mother-in-law's bra size, and click Go, and there, yeah, anything from $5 to, well, the sky's the limit, you know what I mean. I mean, we're not asking for anybody to buy us a 30-seat Gulfstream jet here. I mean, we're pretty happy with the Rolls-Royce crossover vehicle, and one of these days we'll get the Range Rover out of the Land Rover out of the shop after sucking up all that sand in the Paris to Dakar rally, and get the cabana boy and the pool guy and Agnes's masseurs all caught up today. But anyway, we've got a challenge on the table. Your 5 becomes 10, your 10 becomes 20, your 50 becomes 100, all the way up to your 75 becomes 150, if we can raise $150 this evening. Okay? Cool. Wonderful. If you prefer to participate by virtue of the United States Mail Service, the United States Postal Service, you can always send checks and money orders to The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. Remembering that all checks and money orders should never be made payable to Bob Kincaid, but should be made instead payable to The Horn or Head On Communications. Oh, okay. Note from News Ninja Carol Baker. Are you listening, Barbie? The chair is like one of the chairs at the Thanksgiving kids' table. It's a Barbie chair, built low to the ground. Yeah, and it's the problem here is that it's a little tough because, I mean, I got up out of this thing last night and felt like my knees were pipe cleaners or something. They've been, yeah, but you get the idea. So, yeah, it is, and thank you, Randy and PA, loud and clear on iTunes on my back, Bob. Thank you very much indeed. Randy, like I said, I wanted to start the evening with something that Beth posted on my Facebook page. One of those things that you read and you, what? No, really? And you go running off to the Onion to make sure that it hasn't snuck, or maybe the Daily Current, who are spectacularly unfunny. Yeah. No, this is this comes from, and I'm not kidding, this is verified by The Atlantic. This comes from the Washington freaking Post. I mean, I'm looking at the actual WashingtonPost.com page. It was authored some 4 days ago by an individual by the name of Joshua Moravchik. Okay. And it's long, and I guess you would say it's wonky. And it is stunning in its stupidity. I guess there really are people out there who have never met a war they didn't like. Especially when there's one to be ginned up or people's children to be sent off to one. And apparently Joshua Moravchik is just bored senseless these days. Now, you remember last night how we were talking about, briefly, the discredited bordello that Harvard Law School has become since it started handing out degrees to people like Tom Cotton and Ted Cruz, among others. I mean, Harvard's business school hands out MBAs, more bigger assholes, to Willard Romney and George W. Bush. My God, if I'd actually worked to get one of those degrees, I'd be real, real upset. If I was paying student loans on any one of those degrees, I think I would stop in protest. You know, not until Harvard declared no. Well, but the same thing applies with some of our other esteemed institutions. And we can apparently add the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies to the list of formerly respectable institutions of higher learning that have since degenerated into cheap syphilitic bordellos. Mainly on the strength, or, well, what's the better word, of this bit of psychotic weirdness that emanated, apparently, from the mind of Joshua Moravchik. Joshua Moravchik wants him some war. Now, bear in mind, Joshua Moravchik doesn't want to go to war himself. There's nothing in this that indicates that Joshua Moravchik wants anybody that he knows or loves to go to war, just some other Americans. You know, maybe some kids from, you know, some low-rent neighborhoods of L.A., Chicago, St. Louis. Maybe some poor black kids from Ferguson. Maybe some poor white kids from the hollers of Appalachia. You know, those kind of folks. Joshua Moravchik, on March the 13th, and he is a titanic intellect, (sighs) being how he is a fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute of Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Big brain Joshua Moravchik has. Big bloody brain. Big bloodthirsty warmongering brain. Because here's what he says. The logical flaw in the indictment of a looming very bad nuclear deal with Iran that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu delivered before Congress this month was his claim that we could secure a good deal by calling Iran's bluff and imposing tougher sanctions. The Iranian regime that Netanyahu described so vividly, violent, rapacious, devious, and redolent with hatred for Israel and the United States, is, how do you even begin to unpack that? Is bound to continue its quest for... Wait a minute, I think we have to do this way. Its quest for nuclear weapons by refusing any good deal or by cheating.
Yeah, caught you cheating.
See, this is a very interesting rhetorical device. Joshua Moravchik begins this thing by attempting to suck us peaceniks in, you know, lily-livered sissies that we are, not wanting to drop bombs all over Iran and slaughter a bunch of Iranian children and murder Iranian mommies in their sleep and stuff like that, because, well, I mean, we're America and we do smart bombing. We've seen how that worked out in Iraq, right? In the toxic rubble of depleted uranium munitions and that kind of stuff, haven't we? Why, yes. He starts out by implying, Joshua Moravchik, of the Foreign Policy Institute of Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies, he starts out by suggesting or inferring that Bibi Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, whose election today is being called too close to call, by suggesting that he's a sissy, you know, he's weak, that his idea has no merit, so that the rest of us who know that Bibi Netanyahu is a bloodthirsty war criminal who should probably be standing in the dock at The Hague and waiting for one of those permanent beds they still keep there. We tore down Spandau Prison, didn't we? Damn it. He gets us thinking that the BB... No. This gives force to the Obama... Ah, here's the problem. We have to go into the second paragraph before we get the key player's name. This gives force to the Obama administration's taunting rejoinder, what is Netanyahu's alternative? War? Well, yeah, that is kind of what Bibi wants. I mean, as long as it's a war that American sons and daughters are fighting, not Israeli sons and daughters. They're getting blown to bits in the dirt and the sand. That's something American kids should do, not Israeli kids. But the administration's position also contains a glaring contradiction. National Security Advisor Susan Rice declared at an American-Israel Public Affairs Committee conference before Netanyahu's speech that a bad deal is worse than no deal. AIPAC. How did that thing get worked in there? Oh, well. So if Iran will accept only a bad deal, what is President's alternative? President Obama's alternative? War? War? Yeah, you see where this is going. Obama's stance implies that we have no choice but to accept Iran's best offer, whatever it is, to use Rice's term, achievable, whatever is, to use Rice's term, achievable, because the alternative is unthinkable. How about that? Peace is unthinkable. Because, see, peace is an alternative. It's not the alternative that Joshua Moravchik is furiously masturbating over, but it is an alternative. There is an alternative here. Mind our own damn business. Israel wants to go to war with Iran so badly. Israel's so worried about Iranian nuclear weapons. Well, get with it, fellas and ladies. It's a hell of a lot closer from Tel Aviv to Tehran than it is from Tehachapi. Y'all want a war so bad, get busy. Crank them tanks up. We haven't been giving you $3 billion a year for goddamn military munitions and weapon systems and whatnot for nothing. Might as well get some bang out of the buck, right, Beebe? Here's where Joshua Moravchik starts getting all intellectual. What if force is the only way to block Iran from gaining nuclear weapons? And see, this goes back to the argument that I was putting forward last night. Can somebody please begin this argument without a false premise? Because this argument seems to always begin with Iran's going to get a nuclear weapon, and then they're going to take their one nuclear weapon, and it's going to be the biggest nuclear weapon ever on the face of the earth, and Iran's going to blow up the whole world! Baruga, 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 baruga. How is it that nuclear weapons are a deterrent force for everybody but Israel? How is it that the United States and the Soviet Union in the Cold War days kept a bunch of nuclear weapons pointed at each other as a deterrent to either one of them, using them in a first-strike capacity, but Israel's got 200 or more of the goddamn things, and we're all shitting our pants over the possibility that Tehran might get one? And if there is ever a downside to me not allowing right-wingers on this program, I guess this is it. Because I say that I've never heard a refutation or an argument presented as to why a nation with one nuclear weapon would try to threaten a nation with more than 200 that was cogently presented. But then again, I don't allow anybody on this program who might make that argument, because we don't allow filthy-ass right-wingers on this program. I mean, if Bibi Netanyahu picked up the phone right now,
this is Bibi Netanyahu calling...
Iran! Brooke, brooke, brooke. Shut up, baby. Click. Right. What if force is the only way to block Iran from gaining nuclear weapons? That, in fact, is probably the reality. Where do you get a notion like that? Because, you see, this is how we figure out that the anti-Iran argument proceeds from kind of a nasty racist place. That even if Iran says, hey, we only want nuclear technology for power generating purposes, and we don't really want a bomb, everybody then goes, well, they're just a bunch of damn liars. And yet nobody has a hissy about the fact that Israel stole nuclear technology to build its own nuclear program, from their dear friends, the United States. We're such friends. And that they pose the single greatest nuclear threat to the entire Middle East. If we calculate by, say, something like the size of their nuclear arsenal. Well, Joshua Moravchik, who I'm sure is cashing a check from somewhere besides Johns Hopkins, hint, there's a reason AIPAC was mentioned, and he says that force is the only way to block Iran from gaining nuclear weapons. And then he says that that's reality. And so far, in terms of Joshua Moravchik's intellectual force, I'm saying if he was telling me, if he walked in sopping wet and said that it was raining outside, I would feel compelled to look out the window. And here it comes, the response to the response I was looking for, where we automatically assume that all Iranians are crazy, ideology. God, this thing reads, and I've read it several times today, this thing reads like it was written by General Jack D. Ripper. Mandrake. Here, let me get my Sterling Hayden voice out here. Ideology is the raison d'etre of Iran's regime, legitimating its rule and inspiring its leaders and their supporters. Mr. Moravchik, buddy, you know what legitimates the rule of the regime in Tehran? And by the way, just ask Tom Cotton. The Iranians already control Tehran! This argument really does bring out the stupid in people. Ideology is the raison d'etre of Iran's regime, legitimating its role and inspiring its leaders and their supporters. You know what inspired its leaders and their supporters in Iran? The bloodthirsty, iron-fisted, brutal, relentless, remorseless, miserable, oppressive rule of the occupants of the Peacock Throne, the Pahlavi family, whose last occupant of said throne was Reza Pahlavi, who had one of the more nasty-ass secret police outfits, the Savik, who were known for sort of disappearing people in the middle of the night, who had managed to annoy the serene, blessed, gracious, majestic, noble, graciousness, highness of the Pahlavi regime. That's what legitimates these people. They're not the fucking Shah. There's not a bunch of people running around Iran going, God damn, I wish we had the Shah back. Yes, they had a secular society. And yes, it had elements of brilliance to it. But under whatever veneer of brilliance there was a bloody fisted viciousness. And the Iranian people chose to be shed of that, Mr. Moravchik. Because, for instance, they had had their own government, democratically elected, like we said at the end of the Second World War, that we wanted all countries to have, self-empowerment, self-actualization, representative government. And so they picked a man named Mohammad Mossadegh to lead them as their prime minister, and Mr. Mossadegh began looking at all the white people who had come to Iran, all the white European and American folks who had come to Iran over the years and basically stolen their natural resource wealth from them, and went to nationalize the oil industry, at which point nasty old Winston Churchill had a hissy and begged his pal Ike to intervene, and that was the first great CIA coup. The elimination of the king of the Aryans, thank you, Irish Dave, Shah Reza Pahlavi, they're on the removal of him from the peacock throne. That's got to be hell on the peacocks. Yeah. And the removal of Mr. Mossadegh and the imposition of the Shah on the peacock throne, and the reign of terror began. Reza Pahlavi was not a nice man. Very few people remember that when the Iranian Revolution came along in the late 1970s, that it was attended not merely by people carrying great big pictures of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, but also people carrying placards bearing the likeness of Mohammad Mossadegh, the democratically elected prime minister of Iran, whom the smarter, better people had decided had no business being in the governing business. So it is the long memory of the way Europe and America have treated Iran that legitimizes the Iranian government. And by the way, if you want to make the Iranian government more legitimate, start the bombing, Mr. Maravchik, you ass. But that's okay. It's not enough to say that Iran ideologues. I mean, because you know, only Iran has people that are driven by ideology. Certainly, Joshua Maravchik isn't driven by ideology or anything. No, he's driven by idiotology. But that's another time. In case you were wondering, Iran is really, really, really bad. How do I know? Because Joshua Maravchik says that Iran's government is, and this is a quote, akin to communist, fascist, and Nazi regimes. Yes, well, we haven't quite gotten to the actual name yet, but it's 6:32 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and if you've got a pool time after that, I would remain hopeful if I were you. Yeah. Because, you know, you can't demonize another country anymore, especially if you're a highfalutin feller from the Foreign Policy Institute of Johns Hopkins Universitized School of Advanced International Studies, like Joshua Maravchik is. Well, you can't demonize a country. You're just not really trying hard enough unless you compare them to communist, fascist, Nazi regimes. I mean, they're not just commie bad. They're not just fascist bad. They're communist, fascist, Nazi bad. And it's a communist, fascist, Nazi regime set out to transform the world. Iran aims to carry its Islamic revolution across the Middle East and beyond. I think it's going to get a little interesting when they run headlong into ISIS. Oh, wait, they have! So that whole and beyond part? I'm not so sure. I mean, what is this goober implying? That if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, at which point the United States will have them outnumbered some several thousand to one, the Israelis will have them outnumbered at least 200 to one, the Pakistanis will have them outnumbered probably 50 to 100 to one, the Indians will have them outnumbered at least 100 to one, probably 1,000 to one, God knows, then there's the Chinese, that with their one nuclear weapon, the Iranians are going to turn to the entire world and say, get on your knees and bow toward Mecca, or we're going to set off our one nuclear weapon. Does that little moment begin to sort of bring into focus just the depth and degree of the weird, paranoid, the psychotic fixation that the right wing and AIPAC and Israel and BD and all the other bloodthirsty freaks have in this regard? A nuclear arsenal, even if it is only brandished, would vastly enhance Iran's power to achieve that goal. You know, the goal of carrying its Islamic revolution across the Middle East and beyond. I mean, Is there no way to look at the Joshua Moravchiks of the world and shut up and go and change your armor? Almost stood up to the ferocious chicken of Bristol. I don't want to come off as anti-alarmist or anything, or maybe I do. But do you suppose that we might preserve or keep our powder dry, if you will, for actual threats to actual world security? Because I'm not stupid. I'm not uninformed. Neither are any of us here in the Horn Family Commune congregation. But I'm danged if I can figure out how, with one nuclear weapon or 10, Iran is going to threaten the world. Are they going to get into a nuclear arms race with us? Until finally, Iran is on its knees economically. And they're going to let their people starve while they build nukes? Well, you know, they're ideologically communist, fascist Nazis. Woo! But we begin to see how you can only argue that Iran is a threat if you are willing to engage in some pretty anti-Persian racism. Oh, well, okay. Joshua Moravchik has us covered here. Such visionary regimes, meaning the communist, fascist, Nazi regime that is Iran, sort that one out at your leisure, really. Such visionary regimes do not trade power for a mess of foreign goods. A mess of? What are you, a hillbilly, Joshua Moravchik? Yeah, it's a mess of foreign goods. Looky here, Matilda. Materialism is not their priority. Well, darn. Oh, well, maybe this explains it. Ron and Raleigh with a note. I was listening to You Know Who today, and a caller said the reason we have to jump to Israel's tune is because the Iranians are crazy. I think they get that idea from Back to the Future. That damn flux capacitor's doing it again, huh? Such visionary regimes do not trade power for a mess of foreign goods. Materialism is not their priority. They often sacrifice prosperity to adhere to ideology. Of course, they need some wealth to underwrite their power, but only a limited amount. North Korea has remained dirt poor, practicing its ideology of juche, or self-reliance, but it still found the resources to build nuclear weapons. And my, hasn't life gotten better for North Korea since then? And, of course, North Korea is another country that we say is crazy, who thus far has managed to remain sane enough not to set off any nuclear devices in South Korea or Japan or even over there where Sarah Palin can see it in Alaska. Sanctions may have induced Iran to enter negotiations, but they have not persuaded it to abandon its quest for nuclear weapons. See, there we are, assuming facts not in evidence again. This whole thing, and somebody at the Washington Post said, you know what, this is some damn good writing, let's publish it. When all it is a lunatic screed. Assuming facts not in evidence, because there's just not a hell of a lot of evidence out there that Iran is after a nuclear weapon. I mean, once you get past Bibi Netanyahu standing at the United Nations like Wile E. Coyote holding up a placard with a bomb on it, really, a round bomb. nor would the stiffer sanctions that Netanyahu advocates bring a different result. See, we're back to arguing that Netanyahu is a sissy because he's not nearly bloodthirsty enough with regard to Iranians. Sanctions could succeed if they caused the regime to fall, the end of communism in Ukraine and Kazakhstan, and of apartheid in South Africa, led to the abandonment of nuclear weapons in those states, but since 2009 there have been few signs of rebellion in Tehran. Gee, I wonder why. Because when you're constantly threatening to go to war with somebody, the people tend to stand with the government that will at least make a passing attempt to protect them against the foreign aggressors, which would be us. You know, if we decide to do Israel's bidding. God, that gets embarrassing to think about. And here we come to it, the nut of it all. Only military actions. Do you have someone you care about in the United States military? This is the part that may make you want to reach for the duct tape and the hockey puck. Only military actions by Israel against Iraq and Syria and through the specter of U.S. force against Libya have halted nuclear programs. Sanctions have never stopped a nuclear drive anywhere. Does this mean our only option is war? Yes! Well, at least we got that out of the way. So it's taken a few words and a few paragraphs to get to the point where Joshua Moravchik finally makes his bold statement. He wants a war with Iran. Damn it. I'm guessing Joshua Moravchik is over the age one would need to be at in order to serve in the American military, if in fact he is an American. I don't know. So that's one of those moments when you kind of look up and go, you first, you prick. Does this mean our only option is war? Yes, although an air campaign targeting Iran's nuclear infrastructure would entail less need for boots on the ground than the war Obama is waging against the Islamic State, which poses far smaller a threat than Iran does. Really, that's how we're going to reach this decision? We can just bomb Iran into submission, and we don't have to put any boots on the ground, we don't think, because sort of maybe kind of... What? This is another one of those cruise missile... I don't know if he's a conservative or a liberal, but one of those cruise missile types that thinks that we can bomb our way to freedom and prosperity. How much does a cruise missile cost these days? That's what I thought. North of $1 million, right? Each one? Yeah, I concur, Carol Baker. Carol noting in the chat room, you know, I can't stand people like this asshole. I have a lot of Iranian friends who live not that far from Hooterville. Well, that's okay. Joshua Moravchik wants to bomb them, too, I'm sure. He'll get around to them. He'll just say that they want nuclear weapons, too, because that's the modus operandi of the right. We don't have to have any proof. We just know they want nuclear weapons. Well, how do you know? Because we want to bomb them. Well, that doesn't constitute proof. Yes, it does. No, it doesn't. And then you're just gainsaying for a while. Wouldn't an attack, and here's where I think he really, I don't know, I think this is the part where he spits on his hand and gets going a little bit quicker. Wouldn't an attack cause ordinary Iranians to rally behind the regime? Perhaps. But military losses have also served to undermine regimes, including the Greek and Argentine juntas, the Russian Tsar, and the Russian Communists. Whoop! Methinks he doth simplify too much. Wouldn't destroying much of Iran's nuclear infrastructure merely delay its progress? Perhaps. He likes to perhaps. But we can strike as often as necessary. You know, because Tomahawk cruise missiles are free. And why does the United States need new schools or universal health care or more than a dollar a day for food stamps when, by God, we can be periodically perhaps bombing the Iranians for a long time because it's fun. Boom! And, you know, CNN will be there and they'll bring their fancy schmancy infrared cameras and we can watch Tehran
We can watch little Iranian children be blown into millions of tiny little pieces flying into the nighttime air. And maybe with the infrared, we can, like, see some of them. That'll be fun. Whackada, 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 whackada.
Of course, Iran would try to conceal and defend elements of its nuclear program, you know, because they're crazy. So we might have to find new ways to discover and attack them. Surely, and don't call me Shirley, the United States could best Iran in such a technological race. Because that's what we want our best and brightest working on here in the middle of the second decade of the 21st century and apparently forever into the foreseeable future. That's what we want. We want to spend the minds of our best and brightest trying to best Iranian technology in trying to hide their nuclear weapons program that may or may not exist, and they say doesn't exist, and most of the intelligence community in the world says doesn't exist, but who cares? We're masturbating and fantasizing, so screw it. Oh, okay, I got it. Carol Baker noting, those aren't Iranian children that would be flying in tiny pieces into the air, being broadcast by CNN with its super-duper ultra-schmick infrared camera lenses. Those, according to Frank Luntz, Carol says, told GOP politicians to refer to them as future terrorists. Yeah. And, by the way, Jeremy pointing out that a Tomahawk cruise missile runs around $1.3 million and a smart bomb is north of $750,000. And then there's the fuel it will take. The fuel it'll take to fly all those airplanes over there. And then there's the mamas and the daddies of the people flying the airplanes. And I'm sure America's going to feel so good about young American men and women flying combat bombing sorties over Iran for Israel. I mean, that sure would add a certain patriotic piquance to, say, a military funeral now, wouldn't it? Died for Israel. Died doing Israel's bidding. Died flying sorties for an Israeli military that wouldn't do it itself. Yeah. Much the same may be said in reply to objections that airstrikes might not reach all the important facilities and that Iran would then proceed unconstrained by inspections and agreements. The United States would have to make clear that it will hit wherever and whenever necessary to stop Iran's program. Objections that Iran might conceal its program so brilliantly that it could progress undetected all the way to a bomb apply equally to any negotiated deal with Iran. So we'd probably have to keep bombing them even if they asked us to please stop bombing and said that they would end their nuclear program. We'd have to bomb them a little bit just for good measure. You know, periodically slaughter some of their innocents. Occasionally murder some mothers carrying little Iranian babies in the womb just to show them that we were not to be trifled with when we were doing Israel's bidding. See, that's where the real flaw in the reasoning is. When Bibi Netanyahu says, a nuclear Iran is a threat to the world. Shut the fuck up. It is not. Any more than a nuclear Israel is a threat to the world. Wait a minute. And here's where it starts really getting interesting. You know that because he says, finally. And finally, Joshua Moravchik says, wouldn't Iran retaliate by using its own forces or proxies to attack Americans, as it has done in Lebanon, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, with new ferocity? Not the old ferocity, but new ferocity. With more ferociousness. What a jackass this guy is. You see why he made his way all the way to the top of Titanic Tuesday? Well, this time, instead of saying, perhaps, Joshua Moravchik, who was a feller, damn it, says, probably.
We could attempt to deter this by warning that we would respond by targeting other military and infrastructure facilities. Well, until they ran out of military and infrastructure facilities, and then we could deter them just by bombing playgrounds, kindergartens, baby milk factories, supermarkets, you know, that kind of thing. Parks where lovers go to walk hand in hand. By God, that'll show them. Yeah, we'll blow some Iranian lovers into kingdom come. Yeah, then they'll give up their nuclear program. Then they'll know we're not to be trifled with. Then we'll know that they've been technologically bested. You know, we joke around here about Thorazine darts from time to time. They really don't have them, I don't think. Because if they did, Joshua Moravchik would be sleeping soundly. This guy doesn't need to be let out in public. Oh, I know, Jeremy in Vermont pointing out. But Bob, just think of all the ancient historical sites we could help ISIS to blow from the historical record. Well, yeah, the ones that weren't rendered into ruins in the first place, when the last time some ambitious white folks went marching through there. Alexander's men, I forget, was it Persepolis or Susa? I think it was Susa. Alexander's men got all liquored up, and this was before the invention of liquor. This wasn't nothing but wine. Got all drunked up on wine and burnt down one of the most beautiful cities in the known world. When he was marching through what is now Iran. Yeah, there you go, Carol Baker. Genocide, traditional American values. Sadly, yes. Ask members of the native community. Yeah. But I told you this read a little bit like General Jack D. Ripper. Well, it also reads a little bit like General Buck Turgidson. Another character from Doctor Strangelove, who, when being asked whether or not the Soviets would retaliate against an American first strike, says, "Well, I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed." Well, Joshua Moravchik says, "Nonetheless, we might absorb some strikes." Absorb. You know who absorbs? You know who does the absorbing? No, it's not kitty litter or that stuff that they scatter around the floor of your local mechanic's service bay to sop up the 10W-40 that gets to leaking and whatever. No. You know what absorbs retaliatory strikes? Children's bodies, mommy's bodies, daddy's bodies, neighbors' bodies, friends' bodies, city's bodies. That's what absorbs. When Joshua Moravchik, this bloodthirsty fiend freak, this dangerous maniac, is talking about things absorbing strikes. Wrenchingly. Oh, he condescends to think that somebody might be sad about having to do all that absorbing. Wrenchingly, that might be the price of averting the heavier losses that we and others would suffer in the larger Middle Eastern conflagration that is the likely outcome of Iran's drive to the bomb. You know, the Iranian drive to the bomb that exists primarily in the thin gray settlings that slosh around between the ears of the Joshua Moravchiks of the world and the Bibi Netanyahus of the world and the John Boners of the world and the Lindsey Grahams of the world. Mercy sakes! He gonna get us all killed! Yeah, exactly. Labor man in the chat room notes. I wouldn't say wouldn't get our hair mussed. 10 to 20 million tops. Right. Were Iran, which is already embroiled in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, and Gaza, further emboldened by becoming a nuclear threshold state, it would probably overreach, kindling bigger wars with Israel, Arab states, or both. The United States would probably be drawn in, just as we have been in many other wars from which we had hoped to remain aloof. We are aloof. Oh, look, we're not looking over there. When have we remained aloof to any wars? We're the worst country in the world at being aloof to wars. Oh, look, there's a war. Can we get in it? And even when there's not a war to get in, we'll start one.
witness George W. Bush, 2003. Notice how we're back to probably again with Iran would probably overreach. Well, if they overreach, they'll collapse. Yes, there are. This sounds like one of those 1950s informational films. You and the clap. Yes, there are risks to military action, but Iran's nuclear program and vaunting ambitions have made the world a more dangerous place. I would suggest that on the list of making the world a more dangerous place, Joshua Moravchik probably deserves a spot of his own. When one's imagined fear, you know, when one's fears, when one's psychopathic, paranoid, homicidal fantasies become casus belli, I think you get your own slot in making the world a dangerous place. Iran's achievement of a bomb would magnify that danger manyfold. Alas, sanctions and deals will not prevent this. Only war will. I added the only war will part. That was kind of implied by all of this foolishness. You know why the 47 traitors sent their letter? Because Barack Obama has refused to let them get their own spit-handed masturbation fantasies on with regard to war in Iran. Jesus, Lindsey Graham wants one. Jesus, Tom Cotton wants one. Jesus, John McCain wants one. They're hungry for it. You know, with some fava beans and a nice Chianti. And that, again, comes from the pages of the Washington Post. I mean, I expect to see that kind of skin-crawling idiocy over at Newsmax or Red State. But allegedly sane, sober people got up the morning of March the 13th and opened the opinion pages to find Joshua Moravchik saying, no, really, we can have a war in Iran. All we have to do is really, really want it. If a dream is a wish your heart makes, does that mean an Iranian war is a wish this ass makes? I'd like to just say, wow, this guy's nuts. But there's a certain... There's a certain je ne sais quoi that attends having your paranoid ravings published on the editorial page of the Washington Post. And these right-wing asshats are so furious at that black man in our White House because he won't bomb the Persians that they're just about beside themselves with it. They're willing to commit treason. Witness what the 47 senators did. Ron in Raleigh says, what I want to know, the Iranians have not fought anyone outside their borders since their 8-year war against our proxy Iraq. Before that, it's been over 200 years. Facts about Iran don't mean a goddamn thing. This is another example of how Americans don't learn from the past. Tim from L.A., speaking about Iran, what has Iran had to do with 9/11? Also, this is to prevent Iran from making nuclear missiles? Why aren't we then going after North Korea? You know, the other axis of evil? Oil? I don't think that bombing Iran to hell and back would make our oil profitable either. So one has to wonder, are nukes the problem? Then again, you know, if we got our war on and started periodically bombing the snot out of Iran, can you imagine how the oil industry profits would go through the roof? Yeah. And then we would have to absorb some strikes. No, we wouldn't. Iran's not stupid. Now, Joshua Moravchik has convinced himself that they are. But they're not. Just a couple of well-placed Exocet missiles, and the Straits of Hormuz are, sorry, closed. Then things get real interesting on the world oil market real fast. Yeah. Irish Dave asking, or noting, the Washington Post is counted in neoconsensus. Neoconsensus did it. As an official organ, commonly referred to as a bunch of dicks. And isn't the question really who lost Tehran? Well, there's that too. But we do know, thanks to Senator Tom Cotton, genius, super genius, that the Iranians already control Tehran. Whatever shall we do? Is it the nature of the United States that there will always be some group of bloodthirsty, profiteering assholes who want to send somebody else's family members, somebody else's loved ones, off to do their filthy bidding? Is there any way to rein any of this in this era of the crumbling empire? You know what makes empires crumble even faster? Overreaching. You know how he said Iran would probably overreach? Guess what us going into Iran would be? Yeah, see, it never dawns on the Joshua Moravchiks of the world that that's overreaching, too. We can't overreach. We're the United States of America, damn it. Yeah. So, that's the filibobster for this Titanic Tuesday. Both lines are open, of course. 304-663-4676 is the Gizmo line. And 304-574-8178 is the other line, which we refer to as the Skype line. But that's just a euphemism. You don't have to have Skype to use it. Okay? We clear about that? And by the way, we do have a challenge on the table. The first ever Rocket Scientist Challenge, the Rocket Scientist Have a Show on Me Challenge, is on the table this evening. Our buddy Tosh offering to double by $150, the first 150 that come in. Your 10 becomes 20, your 20, 40, your 50 becomes 100, your 75 becomes 150, however you wish to do it. We can do 2 days worth of fundraising this evening in one fell swoop thanks to our first ever Rocket Scientist Challenge. Presently waiting for the participation of anyone because here an hour and 4 minutes into the program, we stand at zero in fundraising for the evening. So, yeah, both lines are open. If you prefer to reach out via Skype, Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn is the contact address. Just remember, right-wingers not allowed. Yeah. J. jump in any way you wish. Email comes in to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. You can reach me on Facebook, Bob Kincaid. On Twitter, at Bob Kincaid. Do you begin to notice a pattern? I do. So we've got one person on the gizmo line, and the Skype line is open. We will, like I said, take a break. And then come back with more Titanic intellect for this here Titanic Tuesday. And your calls. We call what we do here Conversation Radio. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Fire!
Radioactive! Michael Franti! Let us in, LZ in the place. Gone International with Sly and Robbie on the track. Drums and bass. We getting wild. Text phone.
Just the last word.
I don't understand the whole reason why you're telling us all that we need to unify. Rally round the flag and beat the drums of war. Sing the same old songs. We heard them all before. You're telling me it's unpatriotic, but I call it what I see it. When I see it's idiotic. The tears of one mother are the same as any other. Drop food on your kids while you're murdering the fathers. But don't bother to show it on CNN. Brothers and sisters, don't believe them that it's a war against evil. It's really just revenge. Engaged on the poor by the same rich men. Fight terrorists wherever they be found. But why you not bombing Tim McVeigh's hometown? You can say what you want. Propaganda television. We put all bombing. It's terrorism. Chase down all our enemies. We can bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces. But we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find the solutions to hunger. Even really knows why. They sold lives in the vision of fear. We yelled and cried, no one listened for years. We're like, who put us there? And who's responsible? Well, there's no debating. Cause if they ask me, I'll say it's big corporations. World Trade Organization. Triadual action. International sanctions. Satan. Seems like it'll be an endless price tag of war. Tremendous and most disturbing. Neither death toll is so horrendous. So I send this to those that say the defenders. Send us into harm's way. We should all make a remembrance that this is bigger than terrorism. Blood is blood in them. Love is true vision. Who would listen? How many songs it takes for you to see? You can bomb the world of Jesus. You can't bomb it in the
sea. We can chase down all our enemies. Run, run. Bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces. But we can't bomb it into peace.
Find the solution.
Yeah.
save the world.
It's Tuesday, March 17, 2015.
Most of the building has been destroyed. And many houses have been destroyed. Schools, health facilities has been destroyed.
Another Category 5 storm wreaks devastation in the Pacific.
$300 billion every year.
Extreme weather getting extremely expensive.
Right now we're reaching water levels that are at historic lows.
Scientist warns California could soon run out of water. Plus, some good news. For the first time in history, the global economy grew, but carbon emissions did not.
All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
You know, the willing suspension of disbelief can only be sustained so long.
Oh, Mr. Vice President, I think you vastly misunderestimate your adversaries. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know you've got loads of rather terrible news to get to here today, but I do want to point out, we have been talking for years on this broadcast about connecting the climate change dots and how so few in the mainstream media do that. I want to give kudos to HBO's Vice, who in their season premiere this year really did connect those climate change dots from the melting of the ice up in Greenland down to the ice sheets falling away in Antarctica and how that affects the indigenous populations in places like Bangladesh that are being overcome with water and even here in the U.S. where this denialist movement persists. A big thumbs up to HBO's Vice for connecting all of those dots. It was a great episode.
Yeah, it was truly tremendous. I highly recommend watching it.
And speaking of connecting those climate change dots, we had a terrible reminder of that over the past few days.
Yes, we did. In the South Pacific island nation of Vanuatu, relief and rescue efforts are now underway after a Category 5 storm, Cyclone Pam, directly hit the tiny island nation over the weekend. 24 confirmed dead so far, thousands homeless, 90% of the buildings reportedly destroyed. Vanuatu President Baldwin Lonsdale tells BBC TV, Super Cyclone Pam destroyed all that the government has built in recent years.
Most of the building has been destroyed. Many houses have been destroyed. Schools, health facilities has been destroyed. Cyclone Palm, I describe it as a monster, and it is a setback for the whole nation.
It will take time for scientists to determine the exact influence of global warming on Cyclone Pam's intensity, but it was the latest in an unusual string of massive Category 5 superstorms in the Pacific in recent years amid record-high ocean temperatures. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, at an international conference on the impacts of natural disasters on Sunday, warned that climate-related disasters now account for nearly 80% of all natural disasters in the world, costing $300 billion a year.
Over the last two decades, more than four out of every five disasters were related to climate change.
He called on the international community to step up helping the poorest nations because they will be hit first and worst by climate change. While nowhere near the same level of impact as Vanuatu, extreme weather events are causing an economic hit in developed countries, too. In Boston, it's now officially the snowiest winter on record, where snow removal and region-wide shutdowns have blown a hole in the city's budget and the region's economy. In California, it's the opposite extreme. Due to record drought and lack of snow, ski resorts in mountain areas are closing. And that lack of snow is worsening California's record drought. NASA's senior water scientist James Famiglietti warns that California has about only 1 year of surface water remaining in its reservoirs. That's according to new satellite data. And on MSNBC, he recommended mandatory rationing.
We need to look at the situation holistically. How much surface water, how much groundwater we have. And plan for the future. And that probably means mandatory rationing.
Wow. Mandatory rationing out here in California?
Good luck with that.
Yeah, good luck with that. But if we run out of water, what else are you going to do?
Exactly. But finally, we end with a bit of good news.
Thank you.
The International Energy Agency announced that for the first time ever, the global economy grew, but greenhouse gas emissions remained flat. Thanks to the deployment of new solar and wind energy around the world, the global economy grew, but did it without increasing carbon dioxide emissions. Now, this is very good news if it holds for more than a year.
Well, that is good news, because usually the only time we see emissions coming down is when we have a global economic slump. So the economy is growing, yet emissions are holding flat.
Yes, they are, and that's really, really good news.
A small bit of it, at the very least. Thank you, Desi. For much more on all of today's stories, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us and follow us on the Facebook and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Vanuatu, Vanuatu,
oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
The land where we belong.
Where we belong.
Vanuatu, Vanuatu.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
17 minutes past the hour on this, the 17th day of March, 2015. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Once again, if you didn't hear me say it earlier, Aaron Gabrar, whatever you're supposed to say. Let's run over to the Gizmo line. Hey, welcome to the program.
No, hello, 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 brother from another mother.
Oh, how in the world are you, John?
I'm all right.
I didn't run you. I didn't come near running you into a phone pole again, did I?
No, no, actually, I'm sitting in a truck stop watching a bunch of guys going, drop this trailer. No, no, I want this one. No, oh, my God, Jesus Christ. And then each other out and calling each other names. The little Hindu guy is going, oh, my God, you hit my truck. You son of a bitch. And it's just going downhill from there, so I'm just watching with amusement.
On St. Patrick's Day, no less.
Of course. Of course, they don't give a damn about St. Patrick. As far as they're concerned, he's a heathen. But, but, yeah, your subject matter was interesting, and partly because I'm sitting here playing a game called Civ 5, which, interesting within its own limited nature, but it kind of built into what you were talking about. The game is designed a certain way to stimulate conflict by placing resources in places where you'll have to go fight somebody to get those resources, and it just really dovetailed to what you were talking about. You know, the United States has always been... you know, especially in the modern world, has been very inclined to want to use somebody else's resources and hold off using ours until we have no choice and make a bundle of money on it in the process. There's a couple of articles already talking about the fact that since the price of oil is now flying back downhill again, there's more crying and whining about, well, our companies aren't making any money and we need to make money.
Well, shouldn't they have saved some for a rainy day or something? I mean, because remember, we're always being told that home economies are the same as business economies, are the same as government economies, and we have to live within our means. Why does nobody ever why do we never have here live within our means discussed when oil companies are the topic?
Well, you know, it's that wonderful magic thing, you know. You can stick a straw in the ground, take it out, and it just seems to print money, you know. It's like a big, giant sucking sound. Money. But, you know, it's the saddest thing in the world, you know. Oil is extremely valuable for making plastics and pharmaceuticals and things like that, and yet we... to laminate good old Mr. Spock, blessed be his wonderful life.
Yes.
You know, there's logic there, and there's real logic. You can take and make something, a plastic thing that you could then use, and then when you need to change it or otherwise, you can recycle it. But if you stick it in a tank and burn it, it's gone.
See, I think I saw some story the other day about how Neil deGrasse Tyson said there's every reason in the world. If there's a reason to think there are aliens out there, there's a reason to think they've already been here and found us not worth getting to know. And really, yeah. If you were observing us, and I was just thinking about this the other day. I don't know why, because I'm a weirdo. But here we are on a planet. Here we are living on a planet, and let's say you're an alien race just kind of looking in. Here we are living on a planet that does nothing but generate energy. The tides generate energy. The winds contain energy. The sun beams energy down upon us. Energy, 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 energy. The core of the Earth generates energy. And the only way we can figure out a way to run anything is by setting fire to the planet? I mean, if you were an alien, wouldn't you go, I mean, wouldn't that just be a great big nine-fingered facepalm?
Yeah. It just kind of goes back to what we talked about before. This freaking people, especially in this country, they worship little green pieces of paper with dead white people on it. And...
Yeah, have you noticed that? Have you noticed, John, that there is a move afoot to get Andrew Jackson off the $20 bill, yay, and B, because I know this is just almost unthinkable in the middle of the second decade of the 21st century, put a woman somewhere on the currency.
You heathen.
I know.
What are you thinking of? Do you want to cause another civil war?
Well, I was thinking, we can't be giving the women folk a lot of the money, but we could maybe rotate some faces along on the $20 bill. How about maybe Harriet Tubman on the 20 for a while, and then we could replace her with Helen Keller, and after Helen had had a turn on the 20, we could replace her with Mother Jones, and then we could replace her, and maybe we need to start the whole ball rolling with Sacagawea. Because the stupid
order a little bit there, you know.
Well,
you stick Harriet Tubman on, you're sticking both a woman and a black on the same freaking thing. Holy crap! You got to ease into it there a little bit.
Yeah, I know the urine-colored snake flag wavers would refuse to use $20 bills, wouldn't they?
Well, now if you want to do it right, put Kim Kardashian on. That would be a good $20 bill there. You know, that would be nice and modern, and you know, it might at least get some of the youth vote anyway. You know, come on now, they don't even know who the hell Harriet Tubman is. Gotta stick with what they know.
Yeah, she was an outside agitator, wasn't she?
Oh yeah, well, you know, that whole social change and you know equality and you know. And equal treatment? Holy, come on. The whole point of being rich is to be special.
I know. And here on St. Patrick's Day, you know, I had to mention a great Irish-American woman, Mary Harris Jones, you know, Mother Jones. Who said, pray for the dead, but fight like hell for the living.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, you're just a wonderful progressive, but, you know, if we let you be president for a half an hour, we would have, you know, about 7 or 8 states just try that trick, that 1860s trick again. You know, you just don't worry about you, you know, you're just such a warm and giving person, you know?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to learn to be a giver from News Ninja Carol Baker. Who, by the way, pointed out, if they put Kim Kardashian on the 20, at least I wouldn't mind the money being so dirty.
Exactly. I tip my hat to the wise one. I sat here, and I'm in Salt Lake City, and kind of up in this section of the woods, you know, especially in the trucking industry, you may not get loads out till, you know, the fresh week starts up. I've been sitting here all weekend just... You know, chit-chatting people and checking out the local news and talking to the, you know, I always love coming to Utah, especially if I can run into a pack of Mormons and listen to them for a few minutes. And I feel so wonderful. And I'm like, please take me back to the Confederacy, because at least they're not quite as crazy. But,
oh dear God. But at least you can get a cold beer in Utah now, at least in some places, right?
Oh well, yeah. You can get a beer in Utah. That's not an issue in and of itself. But you know,
I hear there's more porn in Utah than any other state in the union, which says a lot considering the relative size of the population there.
Oh yeah, They're number one in online porn, and I haven't done so recently, but four years ago, I stopped in and went to one of the nudie bars, I'll be polite to say, downtown, and their nudie bars are they act like they're embarrassed, because it's like you're not even allowed to give the girls a tip directly. You have to like put it in a jar or set it, you know, there's a little spot next to the stage. You walk up and stick in the little thing. You're not even allowed to even get close enough to even see anything. I'm like, gee.
It's behind the Zion Curtain. I'm surprised a nudie bar in Salt Lake City doesn't involve the woman taking off her shoes and then everybody losing their minds as she walks off stage. I was wondering how long it would take for this to roll in. We got to talking about women on the money, and Ron and Raleigh pointed out, hey Bob, isn't that Barbara Bush on the $1 bill?
the old George Wash joke, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was her on the Quaker Oats box. But Barbara looks like a million, green and wrinkled. Never mind. I'll be here all night.
These people, they want war. War is, that's one of the most dangerous thing about capitalism is that as long as you make it profitable for someone to have a war, then somebody is going to be trying to figure out how to get one started. And, you know, I remember back in the day when you had, you know, I used to work for companies like Rockwell and stuff, you know, doing security for them and stuff. And, you know, being a security guard, you'd be there at night. And you'd do your little patrols up and down the floors, make sure the doors are closed, everything. You'd walk by the conference rooms. And being very quiet at night, you can kind of hear bits and pieces as you walk by. And, I mean, these people are dead set and serious, man. They're like, well, we got to get this, you know, we got to see if we can get this appropriation so we can develop this new particular fighter jets and new weapon systems and all this stuff. The glee that they have with that is that it's
yeah, that's like the new F-35 or whatever it is. Aren't they down to the point where they just about want to gluing feathers on it to see if that'll make it fly?
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's a sad, bloody thing. The United States spends more for military than, like, the next 5, 7, 8, 10 nations combined, and most of those are our allies.
Yeah.
And it's like, who the hell?
Well, but I mean, you tell me, John, because for the life of me, I can't square this. Where is the threat from Iran? I mean, apart from the fact that it lives in fetid abundance in the minds of the right wing and AIPAC and the Israel, the larger Israel lobby, and in the Likud party and the even weirder right wing party over there. Where is the real, honest to God? And they always say it's an existential threat, by God. Where is it? Because, you know, I get up in the morning and I'm at a hell of a lot greater risk from a coal company in West Virginia than I am from Iran. People in the Midwest of the United States are at a hell of a lot greater risk from Keystone Energy than they are from Iran.
Yeah, but you've said the answer yourself many times. The right wing cannot succeed in politics, social order, or anything else unless they can scare the hell out of you. Because the people that, see, that was part of the thing you had last night. And I thought of my calling in, but I decided I ended up not doing it. But when you have Fox News made a deliberate, you know, Murdoch and Hales and all them, they made a specific decision when Fox News was created, and they spent gobs of money because they were losing money hand over fist for 5, 6 years when they first started. I mean, they were just losing it, but they had the deep pockets, and their idea was very simple. We're going to attack the emotion. We're not going to sell news. We're not going to inform anybody. We are going to go right to these people's fears. And the people that are the most afraid are those, and I'll be polite and just call them uninformed, white, middle-class, semi-middle class people that are afraid to lose what they've already been losing. They sense they're losing, and they're afraid to lose more. And so you keep scaring them, you keep scaring them, and they keep tuning in, and they get older and older, and it's a demographic reality. When you are young, you tend to lean a little more liberal than you do as you get older. As you get older, you have stuff to lose, your mind's a little bit more locked into where you're at, what have you. Now, I'm not saying it's universal, I'm not even saying it's...
No, I understand that. I'm just trying to figure out, maybe G.I. Love Money or J.P., if you're, let's say you're Bishop Willard Romney, are you out there just constantly terrified that some mullah in Bug Tussle, Iran, just wakes up every morning with a hard on to turn you into a Muslim? I mean, really, is that how it works, John? Just because they got a lot of shit?
Well, think about it. There was a fascinating thing on the History Channel, Learning Channel. That's one of the advantages of having been stuck up here for a weekend. I took them a couple nights off and jumped in a hotel room. And I got to actually watch like real TV instead of my 1,000,000,000 DVDs I've got in the truck. And they had a great thing on there about the billionaire class and the whole one percenters that was on there. And they talked a lot about the fear that these guys have. And one of the reasons why they're so damn nationalistic and why they're willing to go to so much and so right wing and so everything is because in the old days, in the ancient feudal times, the lord, he had to pay for his own security, and he could be as brutal and ruthless as he had to be because he was extracting money directly from the population, and if they raised a bit, he just chopped their head off. But as time passed, and you got things like the French Revolution, where the rich people got their head cut off because the people got pissed off enough to rise up, they learned a fat and happy lesson. Hide it. Get government. Build up a government to protect your interests. The Founding Fathers got in really big about property rights. That's their big mantra, property rights. And the thing that these damn billionaires and stuff, their power resides in their ability to own shit. And if you go and if say for some wild-haired moment, let's play alternative reality. Let's say that the Muslim faith comes to the United States. Let's say that wholesale populations are changing. But that has changed fairly recently. You don't charge interest in Islam for money. You can charge a fee.
Yeah, right.
But wait,
that's the thing, though. We've had Thomas Jefferson, remember, Keith Ellison took his oath of office on Thomas Jefferson's Quran. We've had Muslims in the United States for really quite some time, and they still haven't managed to establish the caliphate, nor, for that matter, have they proven to be much, very much interested at all in doing so.
Most of them don't. But again, go back and look at it. This show was so amazing. I if everybody has a chance to look it up, find it. It was on Sunday. The billionaire class, they meet in, they did a thing about, talked about where they have their secret, they're not, so it's not a secret meeting, but they have their closed door meeting in Bilderberg and all that stuff. Conspiracy theories out the butt, but there is an underlying truth there. These people are insulated, and their greatest fear is that somebody is going to take away their shit. That's why they're fighting so hard enough with death taxes. That's why they like to do their wars, because they can keep the population. As long as the population is scared to death, then they won't start thinking about, well, hey, maybe we should have a little more income equality. Maybe we as workers might need to get something back. Well, no, we can't do that if the Muslims are pounding on the front door, and if Iran gets the nuclear bomb. You know, you made the correct statement, but the thing that the one percenters are more scared of anything else is not that the Iranians are going to get the nuclear bomb and use it against Israel. They're worried about getting the nuclear bomb and putting it on a damn freighter ship and sending it over to the U.S. That's what they're afraid of. The movers and shakers, the generals and stuff, they're not really all that worried about Iran getting nuclear bombs, because they think much like you do. You know, the United States could be, to put it in the old redneck fashion, they could turn the, Iran and Saudi Arabia and that whole section to just turn into a gigantic freaking glass sculpture. They're not worried about it as in a military sense. They're worried about it that it'd be the same crap that they're already dealing with in Pakistan, where another, wild-haired, non-Western-looking bunch has weapons of mass destruction. And there is a certain legitimate fear there. I mean, there's
nuclear weapons are scary. And they present a horrifying risk because of because we saw what they did the only time that they've ever been used on civilian populations, to wit, when the United States used two on Japan. So we know how awful they are, and we know what the long-term effects are, and they're much more powerful than they were before. But still, we have created, we talk about you can't put the nuclear genie back in the bottle, blah, 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 blah. Well, we're the ones who created the bottle. Because what we have proven, and look what we proved with North Korea. North Korea proved that if you announce that you have a nuclear weapon, the great powers of the world will not with you. Now, the great powers of the world have done nothing but with Iran. So maybe they think, we get a bomb, they'll leave us alone.
That's the great geopolitical,
Israel's got 200, and the United States is scared to death to even suggest that they don't need our $3 billion anymore.
Yeah, you said yourself, APAC that $3 billion, you can bet your ass that APAC takes a little skim off the top to support that.
Oh, I have no doubt. Some of the $3 billion comes back from Israel and lands in American political pockets. Tom Cotton.
Or maybe
it goes to fund a think tank like the Johns Hopkins Advanced Fellowship for Nuclear Masturbatory Fantasies. Maybe some Israeli money flows back across the Atlantic to support Joshua Moravchik.
Sure.
I mean, talk about a brilliant... for what it was, that was a brilliant piece of deflection. Bibi Netanyahu is a sissy man because he won't nuke Iran. Wow.
As crazy as these guys are, and maybe I'm being naive here, so let's insert the saving but caveat, but I would like to think, and I hope I'm wrong about this, but I'd like to think that there's a nice yellow radioactive line that hopefully nobody is willing to cross. Because if that line is crossed, and I might have said something like this back some time ago, if another terrorist attack happens in the United States, and particularly if it has anything to do with dirty bombs or any of that mess, America will turn into a full-core, dying empire, take-the-world-with-it operation.
I think we saw what happened just with September 11th. This country can transform itself into a straight-up fascist dictatorship over freaking night.
Well, the thing about it is, and I've said this before, cast your mind back up into the late weeks of right after September 11th. As slow as government works, and you've probably dealt with them before as well as I have, as slow as any social bureaucratic institutions work, did it never really occur to anybody to marvel and how fast Department of Homeland Security popped up? All these different plans, they're already out there. They're sitting on shelves right now. And they all have their little cadres of proponents and supporters all constantly. You've got little white paper, you've got little places in Langley. You got them sitting there in Crystal City. It's called the Unthinkables, is what they're called.
Yeah.
In government circles. They're little small organizations. They're giving you, oh, here's a couple $100,000. I used to be a courier and a gopher for one of those organizations. And they're given a couple $100,000, and they are basically tasked with, think of the weirdest shit you can think of, and then see if you can think about how to pull it off. There was a TV show, a very short-lived TV show called The Threshold. It was, I think it was on.
Well, wasn't the TV show 24 just one long example of that?
It could have been. I was never a big fan of 24 because I'm not a big fan of the whole go around and, you know, shoot the world up with a pistol and everything. But The Threshold was very interesting because the little woman in that, she was essentially a doctor or professor or something like that, where her job was she was the person who thought of what they call protocols. The unlikely event, something happened, and in the case of this particular show, it was aliens landed on Earth, these weird things, and they discovered it, and it did what they called, they activated the protocol, and suddenly she's in charge of this outfit and all this other stuff. This is the same stuff I'm talking about. There are little cliques in the government that, as unlikely as something would happen, they are already thinking of ways to deal with it or to take advantage of it or however you want to look at it. And the political center, going back kind of what I was talking about, that's their greatest fear in the world because their entire power rests on a concept of property rights and legal precedents and legal things that go, you know, the whole social, political, economic structure as it stands now. They can make the most profit in conflict. Be it war, be it social disorder, be it the prison system, whatever. Those are where your profits are. That's where the big money is. If you can fight a drug war, you've got prison systems. You've got a massive legal complex that people have to go to get lawyers to fight cases and all this other back and forth and stuff like that. The military, same thing. You get yourself a nice little war in Grenada or Nicaragua or do a little few bombing runs, you know. One defense secretary, I think it was Carlucci. He fessed at one time. You know, he was a little bit fucky about the fact that back when they were doing the attack of the first Gulf War, he was complaining that we were sending $1 million Tomahawk missile to take out a $15,000 radar escalation. God damn it, we're spending money like water. You know.
Well, do you remember when Donald Rumsfeld complained that there weren't enough? There wasn't enough cool shit to blow up in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Yeah, the United States has an amazing technological superiority over most of our opponents because America doesn't like putting boots on the ground. We don't like risking our sons and daughters if we can help it. We love to fly overhead with a cruise missile. Now we're using remote-controlled drones and stuff. And in a way, that's actually a very dangerous thing because it depersonalizes warfare. Because now the American public won't even, they're not as complaining as they used to be because imagine the anti-war protests if we had to not only send a couple hundred thousand people into Iraq to fight, but actually have thousands and tens of thousands of casualties. The outrage would be beyond belief.
Well, that's why this goober Muravchik has to posit it as, you know, we don't have to do it with boots on the ground. We'll just bomb them a lot.
Oh, sure. I talked to a Sunni guy that drives a truck a few weeks ago. And he talks to his people back home. And he and I had a very fascinating discussion. And he told me something that I kind of instinctively knew, but he crystallized it for me. To most of the people in the Middle East, they hate America. Not, you know, they love America in some ways because of, you know, their advances and all that. But one of the things, they think America does not have any honor because we aren't willing to bleed for our beliefs. We we will, you know, we'll come and bomb a, we'll bomb a wedding party with a freaking drone to try to kill one guy and kill 20 people and a bunch of kids and some women and what have you, or blow a damn school up because we think that, you know, Ali Ahmed terrorist Islam Babouli happens to be in the building. And yet they look at us and say, you're a bunch of damn cowards. You won't come and stand in front of us and fight, but you'll fucking shoot a missile at us from
a right. And see, that is a really, really ancient mindset, which is not to say mm-hmm. that it's a bad mindset. I forget who I was talking with one night. I've been reading this book about ancient Roman and Greek military tactics, and early on, the Greeks developed a real distaste for projectile weapons. They felt like if you died in battle because you got shot with an arrow, that it was kind of undignified and ignominious, that, you know, to die in battle was one thing, but to die in battle without facing, you know, without facing your killer, without squaring off mano yeah. a mano, and it's all so much, whether it's a projectile weapon, it's, you know, the guy who says we have no honor because we'll shoot a missile, but we won't stand face to face, you know, it's all so much macho bullshit. Because, you know what, once upon a time, John, a bunch of redheaded barbarians came down out of the Macedonian hills calling themselves Greeks, and the rest of the Greece was going, well, you could have fooled us, led by a punk kid named Alexander, and they stood face to face with the Persians and whipped that ass. I mean, beat it bad. Ran them all the way, and that's how Alexander's troops wound up getting liquored up and burning down an entire city one night. But you know, went all the way to the Indus River, for Christ's sakes. But that's, yeah. you know, but again, that is so much macho bullshit.
Well,
it takes, and I mean, I'm not calling bullshit on you. I'm calling bullshit on the concept.
No,
I hope you understand. Peace is hard work. Peace is a hell of a lot harder work than war is. War is easy. You just give in to all of your baser instincts. You give up everything even resembling your common humanity. You give people some snappy uniforms to feel good about. You feed them some bullshit lines about honor and duty, and you say, go murder people.
Sure. American Psycho, baby. That's how it works. That's, people have always been, you know, how do you best say it? Yeah, in order to get somebody to fight a war for you, you have to gin it up as if somehow that even if they die, it's going to be this thing that's going to be written in the history books. You know? And America, I mean, hell, we go back to the Revolutionary War. People forget that less than half the population of the country supported that war. And most of the ones that did
sure.
were mostly from the, you know, landed gentries and the
right
know,
and if you
the wealth class.
Exactly. And if you spend any time with Dr. Bill at all, you'll find out that the Constitution was created because the landed gentry and the wealth class of the Northeast said, wait a minute, this revolution we had might endanger our wealth. We better do something to make sure it's protected. And that's where the Constitution comes from. It doesn't come from some high-minded, noble ideal about freedom. It's wealth protection, just like all other power structures are. I'm sorry, I'm just about spitting at the microphone at this point. Damn. Hey, John, this has been a great conversation, but folks are lining up, and I want to roll along. But you've got things going quite well. Behave yourself in Salt Lake City. I hear it's a veritable Sodom and Gomorrah of sin.
Well, there's been three or four Mormons knocking on my door over the last couple of days going, would you like to hear about Jesus Christ? And I said, nope. Later, dude.
Later, John. See ya. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Our buddy John calling not from the road, but from behind the Zion curtain. Let's run over to the Skype line. Hey, Bill.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. I'm okay. Good conversation, by the way.
Yeah, John's something, isn't he?
Yep. And you started out with the St. Patrick's Day stuff, you know, and of course you and I know how welcome the Irish were in this country when they came here.
Well, it depends on which version, but yeah, especially the post-famine Irish, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The signs all over the place, no Irish need apply for employment. Of course, yep. The Irish Brigade of the Army of the Potomac, they made a name for themselves. I think they broke the Confederate line at the Sunken Road in Antietam. And there's a statue, there's a monument in Gettysburg. I walked out of nowhere and there's that Celtic cross and a wolfhound curled around the bottom of it. I said, my God. Because those men spent a fortune, you know, on all those markers and monuments at the Civil War battlefields. And there, and by the Southern, this is all kind of monuments to the Southern Army, too, there. Put up by daughters of the Confederacy, you know, and the different groups. There was two stamps. When I was collecting stamps in the early 50s, you know, that was a big pastime, big hobby in those days, in the old days, you know. And there was a Confederate soldier stamp and a Union soldier stamp that were being, you know, you could use them. Collectors had them, you know. But, of course, there's this line about the Stalin. I think I told you the one about the Stalin stamp that didn't work because the people were spitting on the wrong side.
Yeah, I love that.
I love that. But anyway, St. Patty's Day this morning, I was listening to a sports talk show that I listened to early in the morning, and these guys were on a location. And my God, by noon, this place was just falling down drunk. And I remember how it was. I played some St. Patty's Days, and by the evening, holy crow! I don't mean Croatian either. I mean, unbelievable. I think this is this more booze is sold on St. Patrick's Day than on New Year's Eve, of course. The other night that was always big was the night before Thanksgiving was always a great night to work
I was going to ask you, you must certainly, throughout your long and storied career, you must have played a few St. Patty's gigs.
Oh, yeah. They were,
I don't know how you make Chicago Blues sound like,
when Irish fans are smiling or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Tour-a-lure-a-lure. Yes, yeah, that's a tour-a-lure. And Mac DeMarco's band.
And Danny Boy. You save Danny Boy for when they're good and weepy.
Oh, yeah.
The pipes are calling.
Yep. Well, what's with these bagpipes between the Irish and the Scots? What the heck was that all about, anyhow?
I don't know. I think it was developed from the sound the sheep make. And I'm not talking about your garden variety bleating either.
No.
I'm talking about the, that's just dad kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And I say this as Scots-Irish, so I can do that.
Yeah. Well, there's a guy who, a guy named Rufus Harley, who was a jazz musician, who played jazz on bagpipes. You'd have to dig him up somehow, but he was...
No, let's let him stay there, okay? I can take bagpipes in small, small doses.
I'm with you. I used to play this St. Patrick's Day. Every St. Patrick's Day, they'd bring in some pipers. And I had to go outside because I just, you know, how much of that can you take?
I remember being in Washington, D.C. On St. Patty's Day, and we were, because this all makes sense, Bill. I was in Washington, D.C. several years ago on St. Patty's Day, and there was an Irish pub in the corner of a building, of a red roof inn, wait for it, in Chinatown. And they brought a piper in, and... He wound up having to play outside on the corner. Even the people in the Irish pub didn't want him in there. Hey, we're trying to drink in here.
Yeah, that's the guy, you know. Well,
wait. My favorite bagpipe joke. So this guy walks into a bar with an octopus.
Yeah.
And he looks at the bartender and says, Bartender, I'll trade you. I'll bet you a beer that my octopus here can play the piano over in the corner. And he goes, well, you're on. And he sets the octopus down, and the octopus kind of leans back on that bag of skin he's got for a head, and puts all eight legs up there on the 88s, and begins playing, playing Chopin perfectly. You know, yeah. And bartender gives the guy his beer. After a little while, the guy gets done with his beer and says, how about a bet for another beer? And he says, sure. What do you say your octopus plays the saxophone over there? Sure enough, the octopus goes over and plays the saxophone. Guy gets his beer. And they go on. Octopi are great drummers, Bill. Guy gets another beer. Finally, the bartender decides to get cute. And he says, all right, your octopus is such a progeny. Have him play those bagpipes over there. And so he goes over and sets the octopus down next to the bagpipes, and the octopus looks at the bagpipes, and he looks at the bagpipes, and he looks at the bagpipes, and the guy goes, well, go on, play it. The octopus looks back at the guy and says, play it. If I can get his pajamas off, I'm going to fuck it.
Oh, that deserves something.
Now, like I said, how many bagpipe jokes are there out there? But that's my favorite.
Not too many. There's nothing funny about them. I can see why guys would go to war. You know, if I had to listen to that stuff, I'd go charge the enemy.
Well,
maybe dying
I'd put them. I'd put the pipers out front too.
Oh yeah, here you guys lead the way, please. At least we'll get rid of them. This Iranian thing.
Oh wait, Bill, we got another one. Courtesy of Lottie in the chat room. Did I tell you about the day I went shopping at the mall and locked my bagpipes in the trunk of my hatchback? When I came back, I saw the rear window had been smashed out and the hatchback was open. And when I looked inside, I saw two sets of bagpipes.
Oh, God. The family is full of people with good sense of humor. It really helps in this world to have it because otherwise you'll cry in desperation, you know? Say, here, hand me that 38, open my mouth, insert 38, you know. But anyway, make a long story short, this Iranian situation, you think people would be happy that the Iranians are going after ISIS.
Well, see, I think that's actually the strategy, because the oldest, I mean, this is, you're exactly right, Bill.
Right.
That's a strategy that goes back to the Ottoman Turks, okay, and probably beyond. It probably goes back to when the Egyptians tried to make sure that the Assyrians were going after the Babylonians, because it meant the Egyptians were getting some relief. It was always good policy for whoever the hegemon was in the area. It was always good policy to have intra-Arab strife, and so, because if you can keep the Arabs fighting each other, you don't ever have to worry about them unifying and coming after you. And so, for instance, ISIS versus Iran, there's a reason Bibi Netanyahu's sitting back and smiling.
Yeah, my idea of an Israeli and an Arab are the two men who signed a peace treaty to end the problems, a lot of the problems between Egypt and Israel. And you know what happened to both of those men?
Yeah.
It was assassinated
bumped
by
off,
somebody.
Yeah, bumped off by their own people.
Yep. You know, you can't do that because you're upsetting the balance of terror. That's and inviting. How did those guys? Does the Congress have the power to invite somebody over here?
Well, they can invite anybody they want to, but there's a protocol that's grown up around it that says you do so, especially. I mean. Let's say the Congress wanted to invite Willie Nelson to address a joint session of Congress, which would make it the first ever really joint session of Congress, because Willie ain't coming without a doobie. I've been waiting years for that, Bill.
Very good.
Well, they can do that, and the president need not be consulted. The Congress is the Congress, and it's in charge of its own affairs. However, the Constitution clearly puts the president in charge of foreign policy so that it becomes very much a thing you don't do.
Yeah.
To try to undermine presidential foreign policy making by doing an invite like it. I mean, do you realize that that sick little war criminal, warmonger, bloodthirsty maniac, Bibi Netanyahu, has spoken to the Congress more than Churchill did?
Holy crow. Holy Christ.
I mean, it gets a little embarrassing. I mean, that Bibi Netanyahu is a carbuncle on the ass of the world.
Yes, he is very much one that I wish that people would. I mean, I was a big supporter of Israel because of my first wife being Jewish and my own feelings about the Holocaust and
German antecedents
made me even guiltier. You know.
No, I mean, I don't have any. The Holocaust was a nightmare. Anti-Semitism as it blazed through Europe. Largely on the sanction of the Roman Catholic Church through the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages and up into the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, it's a nightmare. It's evil. It's wicked. Okay, I heard it said the other day: anti-Semitism is not a Jewish problem. Anti-Semitism is an everybody else problem. It's an anti-Semite problem. But disagreeing with the overtly fascist behavior of the Israeli state does not make you an anti-Semite by any stretch of the imagination. And to say that Palestinians deserve self-determination the way Israelis deserve self-determination doesn't make you an anti-Semite either. And neither does pointing out that Bibi Netanyahu, if he were, say, let's say the prime minister of a Central African country that was busy slaughtering its neighbors, that fucker would be in the dock at The Hague. Okay? If Bibi Netanyahu was doing what he's done, if he was doing it in the Balkans, we would be having war crimes inquiries in The Hague.
Yeah. Yep.
But see, the other side, Bill, can't play fair. Because they've got no compelling counter argument, and so if you say Bibi Netanyahu is a war criminal, the only thing the other side's got is you're an anti-Semite. Bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, if they can play the you're an anti-Semite card, I can play the bullshit card, right? Hey, Bill.
Yeah, I'll let you go.
It's been a great conversation. I hope you find your way to a green beer or something tonight.
Nah, or maybe, I've got a good German beer in the refrigerator, good heavy dark beer. I'll drink that.
Well, if it comes in a green bottle, then more the merrier.
Take care now.
Slange.
Good night.
See you, Bill. Bye. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. Let me run back to the email bag just for a minute here. I want to thank Kelly for straight up answering Tasha's first ever rocket scientist challenge. Thank you, Tasha, for making it. Thank you, Kelly, for answering it. And thank you also to Todd in South Carolina, our buddy Todd, for jumping in on the rocket scientist challenge as well. Thank you, Todd. Thank you very, very kindly. You know, you hear people, you know, doing a have a show on me or kicking in 50 or 75 or whatever. And I think sometimes people go, oh, well, they made the fundraising goal tonight. That's enough. But really, it doesn't matter if it's $5, $10, $50, $100, $100. Every bit of it is what keeps all of this going. And there are, and the number of people who keep this radio network going is relatively small out of the considerably larger size of people who are actually members of the Horn Family Commune congregation. I used to say it all the time. Maybe I don't say it enough anymore. Don't contribute if it will do you any harm. Do not do it. But, you know, when you consider that $5, you can't get out of McDonald's for $5 now. you know, it all adds up. You know, we try to raise around $3,500 a month. That's 350 people at $10 a piece. You can't get into the movies for $10 now. So, you know, just a little encouragement. Don't think that because other people are doing have a show on me, or because we made a goal on one night, that it doesn't really matter. Because what we're talking about is a basement threshold for keeping this all on the air. You know, this is probably the biggest radio bargain in America today between us and Malloy and Rick Smith. It doesn't get much less expensive. And remember, when you do contribute, you're contributing for people who can't, and you're making it possible for the podcast to be free, for us to run the 24/7 stream so people can listen in anytime they want to. There's no charge for anything here. We're not out here trying to make a profit. So just bear that in mind. It really, really does matter who contributes and how often, so that the folks who do a lot of the heavy lifting, who are back again and again and again and again at 5, 10, 150, 75, 50, 25, 20, the people whose names I thank so often, so that they know that they're not the only ones. And I try to thank everybody, whether it comes in overnight or whether it comes in during the program. I try to thank everyone so that we all know that this is an ongoing community effort. And we've got the Angry Indian. Hey, Angry.
Hey, my man. How you doing?
What do you know, man?
What do I know? I know we have 47 fucking traitors that are sitting in Washington, D.C. making decisions, and so fucking hateful, spiteful, and so just juvenile that they were really willing to undermine their own fucking government, their own countrymen, all right, just because the president is African. You know, that's pretty much where I'm at. And then you got what's going on in Ferguson. We have this DOJ report, which is no big surprise. I read it. I have it. I've been trying to encourage people to read it. And there are people reading it who are pretty much reading out of it what the fuck they want to read out of it. They don't believe it. They don't want to believe it. And, you know, we just had John Burge, notorious police officer in Chicago, who was sent to the joint. And he didn't do his entire stretch, but they sent him in for basically framing black men for over a 20, 25-year fucking period. And he's going to get his pension. Men were tortured as teenagers. Some of these men did, what, 16, 18, 20-some-odd years. For many of these gentlemen, they did this in the hole for crimes that they never committed. They were framed. And, you know, we're going to pretend that this isn't happening. And, yeah, you know, we had some violence down there. And the violence was whom? There's a lot of questions about this 20-year-old. You know, there's, you know, they're tearing him up in terms of he already had a record like just about everybody else in that goddamn town. I believe he's a young father, and he's not, you know, connected with the mother any longer. All right, so motherfucking what? I can go to Appalachia and find the same goddamn thing.
Time after time after time, you bet.
Time after time, right? Yeah, but you know that doesn't exist, right? You know, we're only going to focus on Africans. So, you know, here's this 20-year-old who already has a jacket. He already has a history of crime behind him. The system already knew who he was. Nobody saw him at these protests until about 3 hours before all of this went down. He got into a dispute with two protesters in the group. Was told to leave by the group. Because, you know, they didn't want any trouble. If you want to argue, go argue with somebody else. Get the fuck out of here, right? Supposedly, he fires from a vehicle. Now, they had already raided the home when they were trying to trace the trajectory of the, I'm kind of tired today, of the missile. And it turned out that, well, okay, it was a .40 caliber, right? Everybody was wondering about that because how many, you know, weapons run around like that for people who actually understand weapons. And then he finally traced it back to this individual who the prosecutor. Now, McCullough is a racist son of a bitch. He's got a shady history in terms of how he applies the law. But he said this in a press conference, and the bigots are seemingly ignoring this. The community basically gave them everything that they needed to find this son of a bitch. Meaning that it was the black activists in Ferguson who turned this motherfucker in, right? So then they have him, and now he's saying he got his ass kicked, and of course a lot of white folks are saying, well, you know, he's a liar. Excuse me, he shot two cops. Don't fucking tell me they didn't whip his goddamn ass. I'm surprised he made it to the fucking station.
Well, see, And I know that, for instance, Carol Baker pointed out on her Facebook page that she thought that it was, she suspected that it was a white guy because they hadn't dragged in a body or shown a picture of a black guy for like more than 2 hours after the announcement. Mm-hmm. But it appears that, I mean, was there some degree of restraint involved then? Is it because they knew that the eyes of the nation were on them angry?
Well, yeah, I would think so. But again, I don't know. I wasn't there. I'm openly saying I'm speculating because, you know, this will be taken out of context. But we have to understand how agent provocateurs work. We watch this in the movies all the goddamn time. People are paid millions of dollars to play somebody who was set up. I'm not saying that that is, you know, what happened here. But this is, you know, you got to ask yourself. Here it is, the DOJ report comes out and slams the entire fucking city from top to
bottom. Yeah.
Causes people to get fired. We find out that I've been distributing this too. There's a photograph of Darren Wilson and Mayor Knowles and the person who is the city clerk or whatever. They're all partying together. So this isn't a secret. Anybody on Twitter and Facebook is pretty aware of this already. But it's being ignored. The major, you know, news system, you know, they got Capehart now of the Washington Post pretty much defending, you know, what the hell went down with Brown. Because one of the things that I want to ask him directly, but I don't want to come on him right now, is that, you know, well, wait a minute. If you look at the DOJ report, and I, as a young man growing up in the motherfucking black ghetto, have watched police officers reach out of their car and grab black men and yank them while the car is fucking moving, because they feel that they can just goddamn do that. Now, it has not happened to me, but I have watched this. And, you know, so did he know about this supposed cigar robbery, or did he not know about it? The owner of the store, it was reported by his lawyer that he didn't report any goddamn thing, that there was a white person in the store who reported this, and that he said it was a misunderstanding because the fucking cigars were paid for. You know, this whole thing is so goddamn screwed up because we have a systemic system of racism in Ferguson in terms of the police preying on black people. Not just young black people, but black people. Just about everybody in fucking Ferguson is involved with some sort of, you know, of observation, official observation by law enforcement there. For one reason or another. And everybody fucking knows this. And this shit happens all over the fucking country. We had the number one uniformed police officer. This was reported on democracynow.org. The number one uniformed police officer in New York City who was sitting in his vehicle. He was off duty. Two white cops came up to him and started hassling him. And before he could even explain to them who he was, they dragged him out of his car. They touched him up. And then found out after they took his ass downtown who the fuck he really was. Now, all one of them got was a suspension.
Yeah.
And we've had how many black men killed by the New York City Police Department since then? You know, there's a lot of different ways I can go with this. I'm not saying that Michael Brown was an innocent. Look, if you live in the fucking hood, nobody's fucking innocent. Poverty makes everybody a motherfucking lowlife. And anyone that wants to argue about that bullshit, I don't want to fucking hear it. Eastern Europe is a goddamn wreck. Look at the fucking crime rate in Eastern Europe.
Sure.
Look at the crime rate in Ireland. And look at how when the IRA fucking pretty much was totally, you know, infiltrated
by British
intelligence.
Yeah, look at the devolution of Mexico. Look at crime in the favelas of Rio.
Oh, that's the worst. I mean, I grew up in some bad areas, but, you know, the City of God, if anyone has ever seen that film about the favelas.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, actually.
Yeah, you know, I mean, killing people over there, you don't even think about it. It's, you know, people are used to it. when you get used to violence, you don't really think about it. You simply accept it. This is what I mentioned, the IRA. Yeah, I mean, yes, a violent organization. And then you turn around and you're infiltrated by the British intelligence, right? British intelligence ends up doing most of the violence and most of the hits. So then you end up dismantling the organization from the inside. Okay, that's what they meant to do. But now those guys have absolutely no motherfucking leadership, but they still had that training. So what do? They applied it to the drug trade. Ireland is the number one fucking violent, it's the most criminal goddamn place in Europe. But you never hear anybody talk about that, or, you know, people of color, you know, they bring crime. No, poverty brings fucking crime.
Sure it does. And as Devin just pointed out with a message to me from the chat room, there you go. Consider where some of the greatest crime statistics occur in West Virginia. Hint, it ain't the black community. Because we don't have a whole lot of those to begin with. No, it's places where poverty is most desperate and most dire. Logan County, Mingo County, McDowell County, Wyoming County. See, I mean, and then there's this that Carol points out, angry. 21,000 residents in Ferguson, 16,000 outstanding warrants. That ain't an accident.
Yeah, I mean, you know, anybody can do the fucking math on that and figure out what's going on. But see, here is where you get the literalism that comes in. You know, because, you know, like I said, I don't want to say I'm not going out of my way, but, you know, I will definitely, I get tired of seeing these fuckers that use the Ferguson hashtag on Twitter. And they're like, somebody sent me a photograph of a gun and an old John Birch Society motherfucking, you know, coon, cartoon, caricature. If you even call that a fucking cartoon. And, you know, that type of bullshit. And, you know, you ask them fucking directly, what the fuck is your problem? Really, what the fuck is your problem? You know, oh, yeah, you niggas do this, you niggas do that. And it's like, you know, what the hell are you, you know, and then we find out yesterday that these same Twitter trolls, they've been following the Ferguson protesters around, in many cases following them back to their homes. They're intimidating people like a motherfucker down there. And I didn't mean to go on a tangent just now, but, you know, this is the mentality in which we're dealing with. Now, you were talking earlier about, you know, war and fascism with other people and, you know, Mussolini and what have you. You know, we think a lot about Hitler and we think a lot about Mussolini, but we never really look at, Greece in terms of fascism. We never think of Portugal in terms of fascism. We never think of what was going on in South America, you know, with Pinochet, or the Peron thing in Argentina. I mean, they were hiding German Nazis for American intelligence down there.
Sure.
The spender, yeah. Right? You know, all of that.
You know, but I think what you say about poverty has so much truth, because Will from Chicago just told me, and Will just kicked in to help this evening, and thank you very much, Will. Will notes there's an old saying in the Talmud, and it is this. Of all the evils of this world, poverty is the worst, as it breeds all the others.
Yeah, and this is why I mentioned fascism, because I'm still working on that same goddamn piece I told you about last October, because things just keep rolling that substantiate my fucking thesis. Wherever you see fascism jump up, poverty was there in the first place. Total austerity. And if you want to look at Germany, think about what happened with the treaty that they were forced to sign, the Treaty of Versailles, and what happened to the German economy right after that. Hitler could not have arisen if the conditions, the economic conditions, were not the way that they were. I truly believe that, because fascism has never popped up in rich countries where they had egalitarian systems where everybody had. It pops up when almost nobody has, and the cutthroats decide to, you know, basically run a populist campaign, just like the Nazis. They called themselves the National Socialists. They were not socialists. They were murdering communists every chance they got. They were murdering socialists every chance they got. Because I know a lot of people don't realize the difference. But they certainly tricked the working man into backing them, even though the working man really got nothing out of it. Krupp Steel got out of it. You know, the Bush family got from it, you know.
Yeah. Hey, look at Henry Ford. Look at IBM.
Henry Ford was out here saying that the Jew is trying to, you know, take everything from you.
Well, what was the name of his newspaper
The Dearborn Independent.
Yeah, the Dearborn Independent, and it was nothing but a fascist, anti-Semitic scandal sheet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And nobody talks about that. I mean, how about Lucky Lindy? I mean, he was a car carrying member of the fucking Nazi Party.
And then of course there was which one of those awful royals abdicated to marry Wallace Simpson?
Oh yeah.
And you know they just love that Mr. Hitler.
Well, they were at the Wedelsburg with everybody else. He's on film. But the two of them were on film. I mean, Churchill was like, hey, let him fucking go. Let him leave. We're at war with these bastards. Or we're going to be. Let him go. You know, he had no sympathy for anybody. Royal family.
And see, that's just to sort of loop it back around to, for instance, this asshat's article about, you know, why we need to bomb Iran. You know, it is possible for the world's only Jewish state to behave in fascist fashion. Fascism is political, not religious,
mm-hmm.
nor ethnic.
Well, it can be. See, in the case of fascism in the Arab world, and this is another reason why it's taken me so long to write this, because it's very complicated, and it's really becoming even more clear to me that the West doesn't know what the fuck they're talking about, or the people who do know what they're talking about are not being allowed to speak. You know, like somebody, well, you know, pick anybody who's written a book or tried to write a book recently and has been getting hassled. I'm finding out that you have religious fascism there in terms of, say, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, the Islamic Front, or the Islamic State, actually. And then you have secular fascism, which would be what's going on in Syria, right? Which would be what was going on, with Saddam in Iraq. And, you know, it's popped up in different versions in Lebanon and what have you.
And one of the fundamental problems of the United States in terms of our foreign policy is that over time it appears pretty obvious that we have, we've got a taste for it, Angry. I mean, we like to prop up fascist dictatorships because they tend to breed stability that makes it possible for America to do the business of America, and the business of America is business.
Yeah, but not Bob Dole, right? Yeah, but not
Calvin Coolidge.
No, Bob Dole said it too. Well, he probably ripped them off.
Yeah, he was ripping off
Coolidge. But Woodrow Wilson used to say the same thing: wherever the American flag goes, the military needs to follow. You know, it really comes down to the same fucking thing. These are small bands of cutthroats who don't do the fucking work themselves. And they've managed to convince the masses that, you know, somehow, if I get something, you're going to get it. I mean, when the Bishop Romney, and we need to point that out, he's a fucking bishop. He's not a...
I always refer to him as Bishop Romney.
Yeah, he's not a lay Mormon, all right? And this really gets me that so many, Christians...
No, the lay Mormons are at the strip bar that John was talking about. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a bad joke. I'm sorry.
No, it's not a joke. I've been to Salt Lake. I know exactly what he's talking about, in any case, he said this, not just, corporations are your friend. Listen to the entire, debate that he's getting into with this activist. He said flat out that when corporations get rich, it goes back to the people. That's a fucking lie. That's a lie. And there are so many fucking, goddamn Republicans out by me. And I'm talking about not the people that I associate with who are honest fucking Republicans. I'm talking about the creeps who call themselves teabaggers and what the fuck have you and want to, go to war with every fucking buddy, who are always yelling at people, who always want to come to the fucking Dairy Queen over here with their goddamn rifle and shit. These sons of bitches don't know a fucking thing about politics. They want to argue all of this and will tell me that Romney was correct, that when the corporations get rich, we get the dividends. And it's like, well, how do we get the dividends? And he goes, oh, we do, you don't so see it. We do, you're just a goddamn liberal. I'm like, I'm not a fucking liberal. Yo, yeah, just the fuck you are. I said, why? Because I don't agree with you. That's right. See, you can't reason with anybody like that.
No, and see, the takeover's almost complete. It really is. Both socially, culturally, and governmentally. I mean, here's this guy in the Washington Post, Angry, who is uh,
who is angry at Barack Obama for using a time-tested strategy, brutal though it is, in the Arab world. Okay, it's not the Muslim world; it's the Arab world. We're talking about Persian on, you know, and the antipathies that exist between Persians and Arabs goes back way longer than the rise of the Prophet. Okay, but he, yeah, this guy's what's his name, Moravchik or whatever? I've forgotten it already. He's pissed off about that. Meanwhile, and I'm not telling tales out of school. We walked in today for an appointment for Ferg at another healthcare facility, and son of a gun, guess what TV network is playing in the waiting room? Hint, it weren't the Weather Channel. It's Fox.
Always. I go to get donuts, they're playing fucking Fox. See, these people are from Korea. And I ask them, why do you play this? And they say, well, because everybody demands it. I'm like, everybody demands it? Everybody? I said, I see three other people who, every time this fucker says something, they're grimacing. You know, while they're drinking their coffee. You know, it's like, who is everybody? And it turned out that one of the elders there said, there's like three or four people who demand to see Fox. They demand it. They demand it, because, and they made the argument that it's the only news service that tells the truth, you know. And this woman doesn't know anything. She doesn't know.
But see,
anything.
But right. But when it's become as pervasive as to go from your donut shop, healthcare provider in a holler in Appalachia, all the way to the pages of the Washington Post op-ed page. What's left, angry? Really, what's left?
Well, they're already telling the school children that slaves wanted to be slaves, and they were fighting the
these targets for sale in South Dakota.
Oh yeah. I just found out about that before I called you.
If you want to do some target practicing in the great state of South Dakota, you can run to your local gun shop, and you can pick up a target that is a silhouette of a caricaturized running black guy.
But they're not racist. They're not racist. You know,
No, they're not racist, but I loved, oh boy, did I love the explanation given when the guy was called on it. The vendor said, well, see, there are black people and then there are Negroes. And Jesus Christ, I remember when right-wingers were having a hissy fit when Bob Byrd said that on Fox. You know, my mama always raised me that there was black people and there was...
Yeah, but see, but Bob Byrd, who is no longer with us on this mortal coil, was a Democrat.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, that's totally different, man. I mean, you can't have one of them saying that. Oh, well, I mean, hey, I don't want to keep bringing up my Twitter thing, but that's where I get a lot of my goddamn material. You know, this motherfucker was like, well, you know, the Democrats started the Klan, you know, and I'm like, tell me something I don't fucking know. That's like telling me Al Sharpton is a fucking snitch. You know, I mean, we already know this in the black community.
Yeah.
And I really hate it when white people try to tell me some shit like that, that you know.
And so that was South Dakota with the running... Do we use the word or not? I mean, somebody tell... I'm a white guy. Somebody tell me. Do we use the word...
Go ahead. Use it in its correct context. Because we need to use it in its correct context. You know, the fucking music system, who, again, the same person I'm talking about, you know, talking about, the Democrats started the Klan. I'm like, well, fuck it. Mia Love is a Republican, and the Klan sent her shit to her house as soon as she won her goddamn seat. Why didn't the GOP do something about it? Why didn't you do something about it? And then he came to me crying, talking about, well, the Dems are violent, and if we stand up to the Klan, they'll come after us.
Hey.
This is the type of logic that I'm talking about you dealing with. You can't reason with anybody like that.
And meanwhile, okay, so let's shift gears for a minute. This is a fun one. I'm being sarcastic.
Sorry for the tangent, but
no, it wasn't a tangent really. I think it's quite relevant. So TJ Maxx, which is a low rent
kind of clothing retailer, and a clothing manufacturer called Tavik, T-A-V-I-K, are catching some hell because Tavik has produced and TJ Maxx is marketing a T-shirt. The T-shirt bears the image of a noose. On either side of the hanging noose are the words, "Hang loose." Now, the PR manager for Tavik is somebody named Kelly McElroy, and Kelly McElroy said, "We sincerely apologize for any offense caused by this T-shirt. This item was released without going through proper protocols and has zero relation to anything other than surfing. We will be pulling this item from retailers immediately."
Bob,
what
a retailer.
Come on, please.
Bob, a retailer just a week and a half ago, at least I saw this on Twitter. I know I saved the link someplace here in my files.
But once again, it's a non-apology apology. We are sorry to anyone who may have been offended. We're not sorry. We're just sorry if you were offended. Won't you please still give us your money?
Of course. Look, somebody put out, and this was sold at Urban Outfitters, the sort of uniform that they had to wear at Dachau and Auschwitz and what have you. You know, the same thing with a fucking Star of David on it. And they said, too, Urban Outfitters now, they said, "Oh, we didn't think anybody would be offended. It was just a fashion bit." Ralph Lauren did the same thing with their Indian line. This is not new. They've been doing this. If it wasn't Urban Outfitters, it was Abercrombie & Fitch, which everybody knows is bigoted as hell. And that their CEO looks like a fucking freak. You know, I mean, they were turning around and had these, like, two Wong Fu fucking T-shirts. You know, two Chinese hand wash kind of things and stereotypical, you know, Chinese coolies. And they did the same thing. They said, "Well, a Korean designer did it. It isn't racist. We were just trying to, you know, do a fat, you know, it was just a fashion statement." They know exactly what they're doing. And they're playing into, just like Bobby Jindal or Piyush or whatever the fuck he's calling himself when he's, you know, alone. You know, they do this because they figure they'll get a little, you know, light. They'll get a little, you know, in the far right. Larry Elder does this. Alan West does this. J.C. Watts used to do this. Michael Steele was doing this. You know, you get a little attention from these people because you figure you get a couple of goddamn points. They knew full well what the fuck they were doing. They wanted to get a rise. They wanted to get into the fucking newspapers, and it's exactly what they got. And they will get the loyalty subconsciously of every white bigot in this country, which is what they were trying to do. And they succeeded. And they succeeded. The show a noose, they're still hanging nooses up at, you know, people's jobs. Every now and again you see a news report of it, but black folks are just like, what's the point in saying anything about it? Nobody's going to do anything about it. We're all being given a message here. We're going backwards. And anybody that fucking gets in our goddamn way, we're going to get rid of them. That's the bottom fucking line. And the capitalist system is going to continue to push this because the more drones they sell, the more munitions they sell, the more weapons they sell, the more people have to be sewn up. You know, the more people have to be fixed and buried. You know, the more people who are going to be suffering from long-term trauma, who are paralyzed from being shot and what have you, or coming back from conflict all fucked up. You know, this is generating money. Peace doesn't make a goddamn shekel.
Oh, and by the way, just because we got it, I thought this kind of fits in. Did you know that the SAE chapter at Oklahoma University's lawyered up?
Yeah, and they lawyered up with Timothy McVeigh's motherfucking lawyer. You know?
Bingo.
Well, hey, they had actually killed a black man doing a hazing incident some time back, and that's not even being raised really, other than, you know, in the black media. You know, they have a history of racism. And the local chapter over here in the Pacific Northwest, they sang a racist chant last year to a busload, I was going to say, because of the other article, at some event, you know, I don't know the exact details, but anybody can go around and look it up. You know, I mean, they have a history of this. This is not new, and anyone can go around and find fraternity racism and find lists.
In a way, you could. I mean, I think I could. Jesus, given the kind of people that qualify as experts on TV these days, I think I could qualify. I was a member of a fraternity in college, and I was a member in two separate chapters, and. I actually learned, I made a point of learning the history. I was liberal way back then, progressive, whatever we're calling ourselves. But I know the history of Greek letter fraternities. Why is anybody amazed? Okay, I happen to belong to a fraternity called Phi Gamma Delta. We go by the racist nickname Fiji. And our little unofficial mascot is a little Polynesian dude in a grass skirt, and we have a Fiji Island party every spring. You get the idea. Mm-hmm. I know what the history of it is. One, Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity was founded at. Do you happen to know, Angry?
No.
The University of Alabama.
Okay.
1856. It was founded.
Okay.
You know, yeah. Before the recent unpleasantness. It was founded by six pledges to Phi Gamma Delta, who had been thrown out and found not to be sufficiently whatever it was to be Fijis. And Fiji is for, you know. The Greek pronunciation of the letter PHI is actually phi. Uh-huh. And G, gamma, phi, gamma, G, gamma, phi, G, C, and it proceeded apace from there. But they were founded by castoffs from Phi Gamma Delta at the University of Alabama. Phi Gamma Delta, in turn, was founded at Jefferson College on May the 1st, 1848, in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania. And because it was southwest Pennsylvania, and it's southwest of Pittsburgh, in point of fact, very, very near the West Virginia line, although it wasn't, it was Virginia back then, Washington and Jefferson was a home to a couple of fraternities. Another three fraternities were formed at Miami of Ohio. And what was happening at all of these colleges is that the sons of Midwestern money and Southern money were coming to get their liberal arts education, and these early colleges specialized in things like theology and teaching and law. They were, to a man, white. And why it's any surprise that any of these fraternity stories wind up with racist elements is beyond me. I happened to pledge a fraternity chapter when I started college where the house was integrated, and it was no big deal. And oddly enough, it was in Missouri. By the time I went transferred to West Virginia, a black kid wanting to pledge our fraternity, I threw a fit, and they cubed him anyway. And basically, I called all my brothers a bunch of miserable racists and stormed out of the room. But it didn't really matter because, you know, I was liberal and crazy anyway. But there's a history here. Why is anyone surprised? Particularly, why is anyone surprised that a fraternity chapter of a fraternity that was founded at the University of Alabama? And Jesus Christ, then there's Kappa Alpha Order, okay? Kappa Alpha Order has roots that stretch back to the early roots that wind up being the goddamn Klan, Angry. The Ku Klan Alpha. This is America. This is our history.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Carol just noted, wait, the SAEs at Oklahoma hired Timothy McVeigh's lawyer? Big effing deal. McVeigh got the needle. I'd find a lawyer with a better track record.
Yeah, but which know, is in, true. In a way, you have to consider if they were willing to go that far, if they were really willing to go that far, because you just don't pick that name out of a hat, you know? I mean, if somebody picks Jerry Spence, for example, it's pretty much because of the cases that he's taken.
Right.
And Ruby Ridge in particular. You know, so you're looking for sympathy, basically. When
yeah.
you pick a lawyer like that, you know, you're not looking to explain yourself. You're looking to...
Well, I'm not. I mean, I'd be curious to know if maybe the lawyer in question might be an SAE.
Well, that's possible. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, you know, those links go deep, and they are people of money, right? or no?
No. Yeah. And see, the trick is, it's the home office that has all the money, and the game is always toward protecting the home office. But see, this is a racist incident. There are all kinds of incidents out there. Pledges die every year in one fraternity or another. I mean, I remember one story that we had a big laugh over, where a pledge at a fraternity at the University of Tennessee was his parents were throwing a fit because he was busted after taking alcohol in rectally. And you know what the parents were upset about? Not that the kid got arrested, but that people were thinking he was a homosexual.
Because that's what's really important.
Right.
Not that he has a drug problem, you know, or he's involved in drugs. No, you know, he just don't want people to think he's gay because, well, that reflects on me. Because, you know, we all do a line every now and again. You know, there's no big deal about that. I mean, that's what that is. You know, I mean, look, remember David Vitter, the Republican?
Of course, yes.
He's from, you know, the Macaca. Oh, I didn't know what that meant.
No, that was George. Yeah, George Allen was Macaca.
Oh, George Allen was Macaca?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Vitter was the one who was in diapers. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
George Allen. Yeah, I mean, like with him, he knew exactly what the fuck that meant. His mother's North African. So technically, he's Arab. You know, I don't think he goes around telling people that. But, it, you know, someone found out that, yeah, his mother's North African. So that's where he learned the term Macaca. That's not something you just pick up on the street. You know, that's like, you know, someone who will call me a Cocolo. You know, it's like you're specifically from the island. You just don't pick up that word anywhere in the United States. You know, there's specific things going on here. I mean, look at the Palin goddamn family. Oh, yeah, didn't one of them just get engaged? They want everybody to know?
Did they? Oh, God, do I
care? One of the daughters, yeah.
That's kind of like when Jack, a little bit ago, when we were talking about putting Kim Kardashian on the 20, said, can we break with tradition and put something else on the back for a change?
Yeah, I mean, if it's really hers, you know. I mean, that too, is some other bullshit. You know, here it is. Black women have been built like that naturally since time began. And they've been hated and hounded and made fun of and the whole hot and top Venus and all that bullshit. And now, because white people are fucking around with hip-hop, I'm saying it like this because that's what it is. And now a lot of these cultural, you know, all of the negative cultural things anyway, you know, slide over. Everybody wants to be a fucking pimp now. You know, all these white guys want to be goddamn gangsters. You know how many fucking guys around me, white dudes, never had any trouble with the law, never been involved in crime, have parents to go to. When they finally get tired of doing whatever the fuck it is they do, they go home and repent and shit. They'll be like some of these guys. I've seen them on the fucking bus. They had a suit on. They went and worked for their fucking dad. They're out here trying to be gangsters.
Sure. Because it's part of youthful rebelliousness. And I'm not, you know, I'm not going to get into that whole, you know, cranky old man business, but. You know, we don't have a lot of in-person black culture around here, okay? But that doesn't stop young hillbilly white boys from wearing their hats sideways, wearing pants three times too big, and talking the talk and listening to the music while driving down the road in their rolling coal diesel pickup truck. You know, when no proper East or West Coast gangsta would be caught dead in a rolling coal diesel pickup truck.
I mean, well, not really, because I know.
Oh, no.
I wrote a piece about this, and I can't find it. There's, like, several things that I've written that, for whatever reason, they're just gone. from the net. But I wrote a piece one time about how black and, well, like very poor black, urban black culture and, like, you know, rural white culture are actually getting kind of together. You know, there's this one rapper called Big Smoo, or Big Smo. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. Big white guy. You know, normally you think if you just look at him, he probably want to put a, you know, noose around the neck of somebody like me. But he calls himself a rapper, and he, you know, does his thing in the South. And when you ask a lot of black rappers, you know, like I have, who are professionals, and they say, yeah, man, I got no problem with them as long as they're real, they're not holding a beef, right? And then I show them a video, well, two of them anyway, of neo-Nazi rappers in Germany and Belgium. The same beats, the same mannerisms.
Right. And, but why is anybody surprised, angry? Because after all, look at the way jazz spread around the world. Look at the way the blues spread around the world. I heard, of all people, it was an interview with Al Stewart, and he was talking about how the rock and roll, how the British invasion got started. He said, in the years after the Second World War, there wasn't a lot of modern music to be had in reconstructing Britain. And you had a lot of, sailors who were sailing out of Liverpool, crossing the Atlantic, and they were bringing vinyl home from the United States. And they were bringing home Howlin' Wolf. And they were bringing home Chuck Berry. And they were bringing home, you know, Elvis, whatever. And Little Richard and Bill Haley and the Comets and Buddy Holly, you know, on and on and on and on. And so he said there's a reason that the British invasion begins in Liverpool, because that's where the sailors were coming home from, and that's where the kids were hearing the music from. And he said it just so happened that, for instance, John Lennon's daddy was a merchant seaman. And so so it filters, you know, it filters into Great Britain that way, and then it turns around and comes back to us and rock and roll. You know, it's in the nature of art.
Well, it is and it isn't. But there was also a social revolution going on, in the sense, right after World War II in Britain, that the press didn't start to recognize until about 1950, 1951, and it was called the New Look. And these were young men who, they had a little extra spending money, so they started buying cravats, you know, of shirt scarves, and they started tailoring their sport jackets, and they started wearing coifs, and, you know, they started to congregate and so on. So after a while, the press started to realize that they were a distinct group, and they listened to exactly what it is that you're talking about. These were the sons of you know, merchant sailors, for the most part, who came home with a lot of this stuff, and they were in Liverpool and some of the other working class, or, you know, Manchester and what have you. This didn't come out of London. London found out about it. You know, these were, you know, Wales even had quite a few black sailors for some reason in the Navy that went there. Left a lot of kids. The woman who sang the title, Shirley Bassey, her father was a black sailor. I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't.
But, you know, and same thing with Jamaica. A lot of people talk about ska and rocksteady, the precursors to reggae. Well, you know, some black and some white, actually, people who were listening to jazz and so on, took those records to Jamaica and left them. You know, left them with their girlfriends and the people they became, you know, pals with and what have you.
Yeah.
And because they didn't have any musical education, they, you know, try to mimic what they were listening to, and that's why ska sounds the way it does.
Jimmy Page gets his start on the guitar. You know, the great Jimmy Page, Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page, who also was a great sideman before any of that happened. He starts out, there's a video you can find on YouTube of him as a child on a British television show. There's like a kinescope or whatever. He starts out playing skiffle. And there is an old, I mean, you can see him playing, and you just sit there and you went, well, from there to Misty Mountain Hop in 49 steps. Hey, Angry Brother, it's been a great conversation. I got to roll, but thank you so much for touching on so many bases with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'm sorry about that. And as usual, if you guys...
None to apologize for.
You know, if you guys can chip in, if you can help out in any way, just promoting the show does Bob a lot of help, you know, I'm trying to turn on as many people as possible to let them know.
Angry's
they don't
know
that this progressive radio
out. Angry's out there tweeting every day about the horn and about the conversation going on here. Because, you know, maybe we get used to it, Angry, but it really is something different and something special and something unlike anything going on anywhere else. I'm not saying it's the best in the world, but it is damn sure different.
Well, you're not going to fucking hear it, you know, from Rachel Maddow. Not to knock her. She's good at what she does. But there's certain subjects she's simply not going to touch. So, peace.
All right. Later, Angry. Bye now. Our buddy, the Angry Indian. And moving on, is that you, Jim?
It is. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I've been better. It's been the last couple of weeks have been pretty dicey.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, that's just the way life is. It's a question of patience. He wins, who waits, and then again, we lose sometimes, but that's the way it is.
Indeed, indeed.
Pursuant to your last caller, I can understand his what he's saying, and I mean no offense by this, but I wish that he would clean up his language.
Well, that's one of the nice things here, though, is that we don't have to abide by FCC regulations, Jim.
Well,
and we can talk like the rest of the world talks.
Well, you don't have to be, you know, be in excess of it. I mean, 1 GD, 1 MF, whatever. I mean, we've been talking for 10 years, and you have never known me to be a prude. Never. I've said things to you on this program that I haven't said anywhere else. But not without all these expletives and obliteratives. And I find them patently offensive and inimical to the process of what you're trying to create.
Okay.
Secondly, your first caller made some very astute comments about nuclear weapons. And he's quite right. It isn't flying birds that we're afraid of. What it is that we're afraid of are ones that are put into this country covertly. And there's a good movie about that entitled The Sum of All Fears.
I'm familiar with it, yeah.
With Ben Affleck and Morgan Freeman. And that's when an Israeli nuke shot down, was retooled, brought into Baltimore. You can imagine what would occur if that were to happen. And that's the thing that they're really scared of. I mean, references are made to nuclear weapons. Putin made one a couple days ago about the Crimea. Well, posturing, whatever you want to call it. But I think he knows better than that. But Putin got his way. And the Crimea, the landing, the aircraft carrier in the Black Sea, well, there it is. It belongs to him, and it should. It really should. It's part of Russia. But nonetheless, you know, this whole business about Iran and whatever, I think you need to realize that Iran could be a very hopeful and advantageous neighbor because it is going to be the powerhouse of the Middle East.
We sort of made certain of that, didn't we?
Well, whether or not we did or we didn't, it is.
I mean, there was no regional hegemon as long as Saddam's regime was sitting there poised across the border from the Iranian regime.
Well, the thing about it is, whether we want it to be or whether we don't wish it to be, it is a fait accompli. And that's all there is to it. And it could play a very major part against an emerging nation state called ISIS. And that's exactly what ISIS is. It is, in fact, a de facto nation state.
Jim, they don't have a government.
But it can only continue. That doesn't make any difference. It can only continue as long as it continues to spread. Once that happens, then it will collapse from within.
And it can only continue to spread as long as it continues to be funded, Jim. And I think we both know who's doing the funding.
Well, I'm not quite sure. I mean, there are a number of funding sources that are coming into that.
The Saudi Arabians have been, and we're talking about, and I'm not talking about some guy, some guy selling sandwiches on the corner. The members of the vast and growing Saudi Arabian royal family are a significant contributor to the financial existence of ISIL.
Well, I mean, you know, they contribute to bin Laden, and, you know, they seem to do so at their own peril. But one day this is going to catch up with them, because ISIS would have no more mercy on Saudi Arabia than they would in the United States if they had invest that part of the world. And that is...
And of course, there was the story out just a couple of days ago that it turns out our own intelligence apparatus is so hopelessly inept that money intended to fight terrorism has actually wound up in the coffers of these people we hate and who hate us.
Well,
and we're not talking about nickels and dimes either.
Well, there's a reason for that. Think about it.
This story purported that it was inadvertent, not.
Well, okay. All right, we can.
You mean accident? Are you suggesting it was accidentally on purpose?
Perhaps. Maybe. Nothing really is what it appears to be. And how many times have I said that on this program?
Indeed.
I'll say one other thing. Last time I was Seth Meyers with Ted Cruz. Now, that was worth waiting for and worth seeing. I recorded it. The guy came on the program disheveled, started talking about his father, who at the age of 14 fought with Castro, ended up in El Moro prison, and then came out of El Moro prison in his underwear was $100, and Seth Meyers just took that to the limit he could, and it made Ted Cruz look like an idiot.
Bless Seth Meyers for doing it, but I don't think there's a lot of effort that goes into that, though.
I thought there was for him to say that to a senator of the United States, and he just looked at him, and then they got into the business of global warming, climate change. Cruz wouldn't even address that. And Seth Meyers just, you know, sometimes you can just be silent and let somebody go on and on and on and on and let themselves look like an idiot. That's exactly what happened.
Eventually, you hope, Jim, you hope that Ted Cruz is going to have his Joe McCarthy / Roy Cohn moment. You know,
they always do.
You know, speaking of overreaching, but I get the idea that the bar, the standard for right wing intellectual, is pretty damned low when you get right down to it, Jim. I mean, if he and Tom Cotton and Paul Ryan are right wing intellectuals, you know, help us.
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. You know, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, and I don't have all the answers. If I did, I'd be elsewhere.
Well, I'll take you at 3-1 odds over either in any of those in a game of Jeopardy any day, Jim.
Well, I appreciate that. And also, I belong to a sort of fraternity, but it's not like the one you belong to. It's called Phi Beta Kappa.
Mm-hmm. The oldest of the Greek letter fraternities founded it. William and Mary, was it?
Yes, sir.
That's what I thought.
But nonetheless, you know, these people who get on the air and say all this kinds of stuff, and a lot of it is rote stupidity, inflammatory, incorrect, illogical, but they get away with it. But I'll guarantee you one thing, and I'll get off here because I know you have to go. But Cruz got his ass handed to him last night.
Good. May it happen 100 more times. Jim, have yourself a good evening.
At first, I was surprised that, you know, Seth Meyers would have him on there, and I could see why he did.
Well, I'm surprised his handlers would let him go.
Well, give him enough rope, and guess what he'll do?
And that's exactly what it was, because he thinks he's smarter than everybody. Later, Jim. Have a good evening.
Likewise, you too.
Bye now. My buddy Jim calling from not far from here. Hey, time to get out of here. Thank you very much, by the way, to Kelly and to Todd in South Carolina. And thank you to Will in Chicago. And thank you very much to John in North Carolina, Stan, who kicked in a few minutes ago. He said, I love your show, brother. Thank you, John. And John is, to the best of my knowledge, a first-time contributor. Thank you very, very kindly. It is sincerely appreciated. Got to get out of here right now. Talk to you later. Have a good night. Back for prayer meeting Wednesday tomorrow night. Night, y'all.